You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. Today on Talk Nation Radio, Maurice Carney and Harvey Wasserman. Maurice Carney is a co-founder and executive director of Friends of the Congo. He's worked with Congolese for two decades in their struggle for peace, justice, and human dignity. Carney served as the interim Africa Working Group coordinator for Jesse Jackson while Jackson was special envoy to Africa. Carney has worked as a research analyst for the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies and as a research consultant for the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. He worked with civic associations in West Africa, where he trained local leaders in research, methodology, and survey techniques. And he will be speaking at No War 2016, the upcoming conference being organized by World Beyond War, which you can find at worldbeyondwar.org. Maurice Carney, welcome back to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Great to have you back. What can we expect from this session at the conference, other than the screening of your wonderful film, Crisis in the Congo? What are the connections between racism and war?
Oh, certainly. We are honored to be able to screen our film, Crisis in the Congo, and speak about the intersections between racism and war. As it relates to the Congo itself, as your listening audience may or may not know, Congo suffered the deadliest conflict in the world since World War II, where an estimated 6 million people have lost their lives from 1996 to the present. But where racism plays a role, most particularly, is as it relates to global concern or traction around what is unfolding in the Congo. Because we're talking about African lives that have been lost in this conflict, a conflict that the United Nations says is the greatest humanitarian crisis of our time, there hasn't been much attention paid to it. The lives of these Congolese, of these Africans, have been less valued. As you know, that's been the case when it comes to black lives or African lives. There's not as much value placed on it. So if millions die, there is little purchase that is acquired among the world's media, scholars, intellectuals, world governments, you name it. So this silence, that this global silence that exists, that has existed around the loss of so many lives at the conference, we hope to use the platform to shatter that silence, to share with people what is transpiring, how it's connected, the conflict itself is connected to our daily lives here in the United States, the role that U.S. foreign policy has played not only today but historically in putting the Congo in the position that it's in currently, to the point where it's suffering for perpetual conflict, where it has suffered from the loss of millions of lives and from hundreds of thousands of women who have been systematically raped as a result of this conflict.
I think you're absolutely right, but I also think there's a sort of selective moral concern, whether it's black lives or white lives. You look at the issue of Rwanda, which every time there has to be a new war in Libya or Syria, the excuse put forward by the humanitarian warriors is because we should have had a war in Rwanda, we must have a war on Libya, or we must have a war on Syria. And over again, not another Rwanda, although we never hear not another Congo. What's the difference there?
Right. Rwanda has been used as a casus belli for quote-unquote humanitarian intervention around the globe, but particularly in a pernicious way, as we saw in the case of Libya, where the United States went in under the guy, went in to decapitate its leader and really just destroy the country under the guise of the new doctrine of responsibility to protect. Rwanda, you asked the question, why is it why isn't it said? Because we don't want another Congo. Well, first of all, you have to acknowledge that what's happening in the Congo is a product of capitalism, is a product of Western imperialism, before you even get to the point where you can say, why not the Congo? Congo is not held up as a case for prevention of atrocities because those who have been complicit in the atrocities in the Congo have been U.S. allies, in the case of the Rwandan government, the Ugandan government, for example, U.S. corporations, individuals within the U.S. administration itself who have been on the wrong side of policies that have perpetuated the conflict in the Congo. So U.S. engagement in the Congo is deep, as your listening audience may know, going back to the 1960s, where the Congo was the first post-independence African country that the United States intervened in to overthrow a democratically elected leader in Patrice Emery Lumumba, who was subsequently assassinated. And we've seen this playbook around the globe, whether it was Mossadegh in Iran, whether Allende in Chile, you name it. We've seen where the U.S. has gone in and overthrown democratically elected leaders, and as a result of that, plunge the country on a destructive path. And this has been done to a tremendous effect in the Congo, where the U.S. overthrew the elected leader, Patrice Emery Lumumba, and installed a dictatorship over the Congolese people for over three decades in Joseph Désiré Mobutu, and has culminated in the latest crisis where the U.S. has backed an invasion of the Congo by Rwanda and Uganda. So where U.S. interests have played a role and the United States government has been implicated, it's not a country where they would hold up as an example, because if you dig, just scratch the surface, you'll see the hand of U.S. foreign policy, U.S. corporations, playing a destructive role in the current situation in the country.
How does U.S. foreign policy going forward and looking at the presidential election underway overlap with concerns of racism and war? Because we are all told that there's, you know, one candidate for president who is a racist, but there's another candidate for president who has a habit of, as you say, destroying countries like Libya. Is there an escape from racism other than going to a to an actually good candidate like Jill Stein? What do you make of the racism present in humanitarian war making?
Well, we have to tread lightly when we talk about racism and war, and utilize individuals as a basis for our analysis around that. The racism, white supremacy, it's systemic. So whether Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, whoever else gets into power, it's the system that's in place that needs to be dismantled. A system that values one person's lives or one race's lives over another. So irrespective of who's in power, people throughout the globe, people, particularly in the United States, need to organize, need to mobilize, and fight racism and dismantle those systems. And those systems go across the board. You're familiar with Joseph Nye's principles around power, and he talked about hard power and soft power, hard power being military, soft power being cultural, for example, like Hollywood and humanitarian institutions. So these systems, based in the DNA, is this sense of supremacy, which plays out in a way that devalues non-white life, and the policies that come out of that are destructive for people, particularly on the African continent. Whether it's in Congo or Libya or what have you. So the main takeaway and the main concern is that we organize in a way, and that we mobilize in a way to attack these the system of racism. But I wanted to just interject just a bit, David, around concerns of Congolese in particular with Hillary Clinton coming to power. Hillary Clinton was in the Congo in 2010 and had a town hall with young Congolese. And one of the young Congolese asked a question. The Congolese said, Secretary Clinton, how can we as young Congolese be assured that if we elect a president that is independent, that you, the United States, will not come in and overthrow him and assassinate him? And she said to the youth, well, we need to forget about the past. We need to focus on the future. Of course, she's saying forget about the past because she knows the U.S. role, the role that the United States has played in the Congo. But not only in the Congo, the Clintons have played a role in the region. It was under the Clinton administration that the principle, the Entebbe principles were put into effect, where President Clinton visited Entebbe, Uganda, in 1998. And coming out of that, they had a number of principles that worked to, put the region in a dependent, impoverished, and unstable situation. Principles, one of the main principles where they identify what they call a renaissance leaders, new breed of African leaders. And they included people like Yoweri Museveni and Paul Kagame. And a few things that these leaders had in common is, one, they were rebel leaders. They came to power at the barrel of a gun. They're one of being authoritarian figures where they imposed their will on force on the people against their will. They invaded other African countries. They're responsible for the death of millions of Africans, and they promote neoliberal policies in the heart of Africa. So with the Clintons coming back, potentially coming back into power, the people in the region are truly concerned because two of their proteges, Rwanda's Paul Kagame and Uganda's Yoweri Museveni, are still in power. So they, the people of the region, the Congolese and Ugandans and Rwandans, are very concerned about a possible president, Hillary Clinton, because they're caught in a death trap. And they believe that with the Clintons coming back in force, that may perpetuate the suffering of the people, or help to perpetuate the suffering of the people in the region.
And at the same time, U.S. military presence expanding across the continent of Africa, as well as, you know, weapons being given to local police here in the United States. We have just a minute left. Maurice Carney, how can groups that are working against racism here in the United States connect with groups that are working on the issues you're talking about abroad and connect with trying to reform or reverse U.S. foreign policy?
Several ways. A necessary prerequisite is, of course, knowing about what's going on, because the way the U.S. is structured, it makes it difficult for people to, or the way the U.S. corporate media works, it makes it difficult for people to know about what's happening outside the U.S., especially from a progressive or radical perspective. So one is to seek out the information. For us around the Congo, we had friendsofthecongo.org. That's a website you can go to find out the latest about what's happening in the Congo and in the heart of Africa. Once they have access to information, then they have to share that information within their networks.
Maurice Carney, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, Dave. Really appreciate it.
I am now pleased to welcome back to Talk Nation Radio Harvey Wasserman. Harvey Wasserman is already known to these listeners as a lifelong activist who speaks, writes, and organizes widely on energy, the environment, history, the drug war, election protection, and grassroots politics. He works for the permanent shutdown of the nuclear power industry and the birth of Solartopia, a democratic and socially just green-powered Earth free of all fossil and nuclear fuels. He is a senior advisor to Greenpeace, and he will be speaking at No War 2016, the upcoming conference that you can sign up to attend or watch the live stream at worldbeyondwar.org. Harvey Wasserman, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Well, it's great to be with you, David. It's a spectacular thing you do here.
It's great to be on your show now and then, and it's wonderful to have you back on here, and that you will be coming to Washington, D.C., and speaking as a featured speaker at this conference on the topic of protecting the environment from war by ending war. What does war have to do with the environment?
Well, unfortunately, everything. You know, they say that the first casualty of war is truth. The second casualty, of course, is human beings, and the third is the environment. War is really about destroying the environment in many, many ways, as we saw in Vietnam, with the probably the worst deliberate environmental crime ever committed against the planet, which was the spraying of Agent Orange throughout Vietnam with the express purpose of destroying the forest there. And that so often, if you look at the pictures of Europe during and after World War One and II, the absolute decimation of the environment, and you know, the people who plan and perpetrate wars are always interested in taking out pieces of our planet. So war against people is also, and other nations, is always war against the environment as well. And it's something that we really have to take into account as we continue. I mean, the fact that the United States of America has at least 900 bases, with one in virtually every country in the world, is an indicator that our resources are being profoundly misallocated, and that the production of weapons, and especially of nuclear weapons, really is a signal of death knell for our ability to survive on this planet.
Yeah, it seems to me if we were to tax the super rich, you know, once, 1 year, and take away most of their money, that would be a big chunk of change you could put into something useful like human or environmental needs. But if you wanted some way to fund the creation of Solartopia year after year after year, the $1 trillion or so that the U.S. government puts into militarism each year looks like the only place I'm aware of that has that kind of money.
Absolutely. You know, a lot of us, when the Cold War ended, we naively believed that the resources that had gone into that insane endeavor would be redirected to solarizing the planet and putting the an infrastructure in place that would operate in harmony with the Earth, and really much of the opposite happened. So I will say, David, that I think the number one illness, the number one disease facing humankind in our social systems, which is directly related to militarism, it's actually its twin, is the corporation. Because the basis of our economic system is a fabricated organism that has absolutely no response mechanism to the needs of the environment or of human beings. The corporation's sole purpose under law is to make profit. And so it doesn't respond to the needs of the environment. And part of that profit, of course, is based on the industry of war. I mean, war is a business, or a racket, as has been so widely pointed out by you and others. And so what we have in our economic organism is a cancer that metastasizes strictly on the basis of profit, and part of that profit is bound up in war. And until we can deal with that, we're really going to have a very difficult prognosis for surviving on this planet.
How do we get people who understand that problem from a certain angle and want to go after corporate abuses and corporate powers and even restore the power to shut down corporations or restructure our economy entirely, or who want to go after environmental destruction but don't really want to touch the issue of war? I mean, I don't know a better environmental group out there than Greenpeace, and it's got peace in the name, but it doesn't have a single staffer who does anything related to peace. How do we get environmental groups and anti-corporate abuse groups and anti-war groups together to be a stronger movement?
Well, I think we have to understand the common ground here, the common ground of our problem. is the profit motive of economic entities that have no legal accountability, and that part of their business is war, and not only the war of, you know, violent war between nations or guerrilla groups or private armies or Donald Trump's, but also things like the drug war. I mean, the drug war has been, which is aptly named, has really nothing to do with drugs. It's all about preventing black people from voting and gutting the communities of color and of youth that would challenge the ruling elite. That's a form of the war against humankind and against nature that has been very profound and difficult to deal with. I think there is an understanding among many of the environmental groups, especially when it comes to the production of nuclear weapons, that the environmental impacts of this business of war are extreme and really need to be dealt with. I mean, I think most people by this point in time who are active on these issues sees a holistic connection between all of it, you know, poverty, racism, destruction of the environment, and the business of war. They're all really of a piece. And the question is, where do we fight most effectively? And I have a lot of faith in people's ability to, our species' ability to evolve and figure these things out. I just see us as a species being plagued with this corporate disease, this cancer, of which war and empire, really, the key word I think really is empire, that plague us. I mean, the United States has taken upon itself to have troops everywhere all over the world. We now have essentially institutionalized the reality of permanent war. You know, ever since Iraq, the insane invasion of Iraq, we've been at war, and there seems to be sort of this accommodation to the idea that we will always have an imperial war going somewhere in the world. I mean, right now it's Afghanistan, ironically the most remote country on Earth pretty much from us. And if it's not Iraq, it's going to be or Afghanistan or Libya or somewhere else. It will be somewhere else. And that's a mentality that we really have to cut through. We've gotten to a point now where the countries, certainly the media and the corporations, are addicted to a permanent war state. And this is a really devastatingly powerful problem that we all have to face.
Yeah, that seems like what needs to be taken on. I mean, going after nuclear weapons is one angle that World Beyond War is pursuing and others are pursuing and is a workshop at this upcoming conference in Washington. But, you know, I was struck by Gorbachev's remark in his new book that as long as the United States intends on dominating the planet with so-called conventional weapons, other countries are not going to get rid of their nuclear weapons. And of course, we're seeing other countries get nuclear energy for the purpose of being close to getting nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, if you're a pro football player in the United States and refuse to stand up and worship the flag for the Star Spangled Banner, you're ostracized and excommunicated from the state religion. It seems that How do we make it possible for groups to be willing to take on that challenge of, you know, of facing that storm that, you know, this football player is facing?
Well, I want to, you know, with Colin Kaepernick, he's actually a great quarterback. I love watching him play, and I'm really glad that he stood up. We've seen other athletes stand up now. You know, LeBron James and some of the NBA guys were wearing Black Lives Matter shirts. We're seeing, and the columns of Dave Zirin are very good on this. We're seeing the politicization of sports in terms of the athletes themselves, and I think this is a good thing. And they've taken great risks, and we've seen a steady evolution here. You know, dating back to Wimbledon, when the women who were playing Wimbledon demanded and got equal pay, everything now in this country is being politicized by a very, very diverse constituency. And I think, you know, I was very disappointed that Bernie Sanders never really took on the issue of permanent war. But the the arousal of such excitement and rebellion in that campaign prior, previously, you know, the Occupy movement before that, others, I think they're all coming together. And I think it's our job at this conference, David, to sort of put together an easily understandable, shall we say, piece of literature that will link our state of permanent imperial war to all the other ills, environmental, social justice, the horrible prison system that we've spawned. It all ties together. And it's all based on the fact that the United States has become an empire dominated by a classic imperial elite, and that, you know, this is exactly what we fought against in our American Revolution in 1776. But thankfully, we have that revolution to refer to, and we really need to revive that understanding.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. It's what we were trying to do with the website as well at worldbeyondwar.org. I was struck, though, that even, you know, a football player willing to take a stand against racism and police violence, when questioned, "What exactly did you mean?" swore his allegiance to the military and, "Oh, please don't understand, I'm not against any wars," and so forth. I mean, that's just too far, apparently, in this day and age. It wasn't too far for Muhammad Ali or some athletes in the past to actually risk prison over. But now you can't even say it. So I think we have some more work to do, huh?
Oh, plenty. Yeah, sure, a lot. But it's a start, or, you know, it's something real. And never underestimate the groundswell of understanding that we have. I mean, there's a lot going on in the non-mainstream media that's of interest, and I think people, we are as a species, ultimately do have a survival mechanism, and the top agenda item there is to get rid of war, and you know, we're just going to have to keep banging away until it happens, and it will happen. We will get rid of war at the moment we least expect it. But it will happen, and conferences like this are critical to making sure that we have the language and the core understanding to spread around, as we now can do with the Internet and so many other media at our disposal. So but getting this core understanding is what's really important, David. And in this case, the way the world is now, the root of war really is empire. And the corporate profit motive. Those two are really the twin cancers that are plaguing our society. And if we can name them and make it clear what they're about, I think other things will follow.
Wonderful. We look forward to hearing more in Washington in late September, and we will put up links to all of your independent media at talknationradio.org. Harvey Wasserman, thanks for everything you do and for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Well, my pleasure, David. Your work is always an inspiration to me, and we'll see you in September.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersnap.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a special episode in celebration of Labor Day. It's presented by corporate media as, most importantly, a long weekend with a parade, or, more seriously, as a holiday fought for by U.S. trade unions to honor American workers. But the day has more complex origins. A national holiday had been a goal of U.S. labor. Several states already celebrated. But Grover Cleveland declared Labor Day in the midst of an attack by federal troops on striking Pullman railway workers, leading many to see it as an attempt to appease workers more than honor them. It's fitting that the holiday remind us of the struggles as well as the advances of U.S. workers who face today some of the same problems as in 1894, including distant and disconnected owners whose self-enriching anti-worker policies are enabled and, if need be, enforced by government. We'll be revisiting a few, we think, illuminating conversations about work and labor and media coverage this week on Counterspin. Any understanding of the situation of U.S. workers in 2016 will acknowledge that labor is in many ways international. The ability of textile workers in South Carolina to seek improvements in wages or conditions is tied directly to the ability of the corporation they work for to pay people in, say, Vietnam, far less. Among its impacts, globalization has spurred solidarity among workers around the world who recognize that the conditions that a company like Walmart condones and profits from abroad affect Americans, not only as consumers of the products made, but as workers fighting for better lives. After a horrific fire at a garment factory in Bangladesh killed more than 100 workers making clothes for big brands like Walmart, Disney, and Sears, Counterspin spoke with Scott Nova of the Workers' Rights Consortium about how media focus on whether Walmart knew its clothes were being produced at that particular factory obscures the multinational's power.
Whatever the relationship was between Walmart and this factory that burned on Saturday, and there's no question that Walmart clothes were there, it's important to understand that Walmart is the biggest buyer of apparel and the most powerful player in the Bangladesh apparel industry. And what Walmart does is place tremendous pressure on its contractors in Bangladesh, as in other countries, to produce at the lowest possible price. That in turn gives factories a very powerful incentive to reduce production and labor costs by running roughshod over the rights of workers. That, combined with a total lack of regulatory effort by the local government, is what produces sweatshop conditions and deadly fires.
We asked Nova about often heard contentions from corporations and their media advocates that these are considered good jobs and good wages in this case, Bangladesh. And besides, if those workers got paid more, the price of the clothing they make would necessarily skyrocket.
First of all, no job is good if it kills you. And workers should not have to take their lives into their hands when they walk into the workplace. You know, it's important to understand Bangladeshi workers are willing to work for low wages. Unfortunately, they're not paid low wages. They're paid brutal sub-poverty wages. 18 cents an hour is the minimum wage for apparel workers. They're not even enough to feed a family. And so what you've got is Western brands and retailers who are taking advantage of the poverty and desperation in that country to get workers to work at absurdly low wages in dangerous conditions because those workers lack any alternative. But the reality is that none of this is necessary. Labor costs as a percentage of the final retail price of garments is tiny, maybe 1 to 2% of final retail price, which means that Gap and H&M and Walmart and the other big players in Bangladesh could easily afford to greatly increase wages and to ensure that their suppliers undertake the necessary fire safety precautions with a minimal impact on the corporate bottom line and a minimal impact on prices for consumers. Unfortunately, they refuse to pay one penny more to the factories.
As for those corporate claims, cited credulously in press accounts, that they simply don't know who their contractors or subcontractors are, Nova had thoughts about that too.
It's nonsense. These are corporations, Walmart in particular, that work extremely hard and effectively to maintain very tight control over supply chain logistics and production in their systems. Indeed, at Walmart, tight control of the supply chain as a means of minimizing cost is essentially a religion. So it's very hard to swallow claims from these companies that, in fact, they have so little control over their supply chains that they do not even know on a given day which factories are making their clothing. And the bottom line is they have the power to ensure that they know which factories are making their clothing, and they have the power to ensure that those factories operate safely. If they don't know which factories are making their clothing, that's because they've chosen not to know.
Workers die on the job in this country, too, of course. 29 miners died in an explosion at Upper Big Branch in West Virginia as a result of safety violations by operator Massey Energy. Unusually, in this case, a higher-up, Massey CEO Don Blankenship, was to some degree called to account, sentenced to a year in prison earlier this year. Attorney Bruce Stanley told Counterspin, the pressure to pursue such cases needs to start locally, and that's not easy for many reasons.
I was a local reporter on a small southern West Virginia newspaper out of college, and I appreciated the strain that one would feel when making decisions about whether or not to write stories about certain local, quote, powerful local officials. I mean, that pressure on local media is palpable. And unless there is an independent media there, the notion of some young prosecutor or any prosecutor standing up and saying, hey, enough is enough and we need to take an independent stand here, it calls for a conviction that, frankly, most average citizens don't possess. And when you weigh that, against the economics of a local economy, a single engine economy, it gets very difficult. A lot of these miners' families who complain about the safety issues associated with operating in a Massey mine, many of those same families were the ones who are complaining about the alleged war on coal, where coal is saying, hey, we're being regulated out of business by the Obama administration. So it becomes a very, very difficult dynamic. I think it's also important to remember, though, and I do want to revisit quickly the nature of the federal charges that he was charged against.
Mm-hmm.
That is not local. That is something that the national politicians could do something about. That's something that the Congress of the United States has had on its desk for some time now and has chosen not to act. And that's a choice not to act as a lack of leadership from Washington representatives from the coal fields. Shelley Capito and Joe Manchin and Mitch McConnell all represent constituents who are laboring in unsafe mine conditions where, that one-year maximum penalty is all that's out there. They can change that anytime that they want. The administration would back that change, and they know that, and they choose not to. And so that one, is very problematic when weighed against what you know is going to be the inertia at the local setting because of the overall power of coal in these communities, what they could be doing with a stroke of a pen, essentially, at the national level to prevent that. Why should it be that it's 30 years to lie to Wall Street, 1 year to conspire to violate the mine laws, safety laws of the United States? And that's a choice that Congress has made.
One thing media could do, Stanley said, is to stop referring to workplace deaths as if they were extremely rare or remnants of the past.
As I said earlier, 53 men at least died under Don Blankenship's watch. You know, we watched Upper Big Branch because 29 died in one spectacularly stupid explosion. But, there are another, 20 miner, or so underground, one or two at a time, dying because of the same management style, the same sense of dollars over men, the same sense of production over safety that accounted for Upper Big Branch. The laws are on the books. There are inspectors there to enforce the law, and there should be prosecution for the people who disobey the law. End of story. If that becomes the rubric, if that becomes the way in which we conduct ourselves as a society, then hopefully we will get to the point where the Upper Big Branches or the Aracomas or, the mangled arms and twisted limbs and broken backs are things of the past. But put it off as, sometimes I just like to think that, I get concerned that we think that I can turn off the TV and it goes away. Well, it doesn't go away. It's there, and it's not going to go away until that step after step, step by step, mechanical effort is undertaken to get the law in place and enforce the law, period.
From coal mines to fine dining sounds like a leap, but the unequal struggle between workers and owners plays out there as well. And as we discussed with author and advocate Saru Jayaraman, in restaurants we can see clearly how defending workers' rights connects and overlaps with defending the rights of women and of people of color. Jayaraman talked about the fight to eliminate the tipped wage.
Our campaign is not actually at this minute to eliminate tipping altogether. That's a huge misconception. We are trying to eliminate the lower wage for tipped workers, which this industry has gotten away with for over 100 years. The true history is that tipping originated in Europe. When it came to the United States in the late 1850s, there was a massive anti-tipping movement so great that five states passed bans on tipping. And two industries, the restaurant industry and the Pullman Train Company, squashed that movement and demanded the right to hire newly freed slaves and not pay them anything and let them live on customer tips. And that idea that the restaurant industry in particular could not pay its workers a wage and let them live on customer tips was codified into the very first minimum wage law as part of the New Deal, which gave tipped workers the right to a $0 minimum wage. And we've gone from $0 in 1938 to a whopping $2.13 an hour, which is the federal minimum wage for tipped workers in our country. Now, there are seven states that have completely eliminated that system and demand that the restaurant industry actually pay its workers a full wage and let tips be on top of that. California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Montana, and Alaska all demand that the restaurant industry pay a full wage and let tips be on top. And so our campaign, our effort has been to eliminate that lower wage for tipped workers, that two-tiered system that's essentially legalized gender pay inequity because it's mostly women living on the lower wage. Because when you're a woman who lives off of tips for the majority of your income, as 6 million women in America do, you have to tolerate whatever a customer might do to you, however they may touch you or treat you or talk to you, because the customer is always right, because the customer is paying all of your income truly, because your wage is so low. If you get $2 or $3 or $4 an hour, as it is in 43 states, your wage is so low it goes entirely to taxes and you're living completely off your tips. So if you're living completely off your tips, you're completely dependent on the whims of the customer and you have to tolerate this kind of behavior. And our research shows it goes a step further. We found that management in states with lower wages for tipped workers encourages women to objectify themselves, wear tighter clothing, show greater cleavage in order to get more money and tips at three times the rate as they do in states like California, where a woman actually gets a full wage and doesn't have to rely on the whims of a customer.
In restaurant work as elsewhere, sexism also intersects with racism.
People of color and women of color get segregated into lower level segments of the industry and lower tipping occupations and lower paid occupations. You will see people of color in casual restaurants and fast food restaurants. If they're in fine dining, you'll see them in what we call the back of the house, the kitchen, or in lower tipped positions like a busser or a runner who often earns one-fifth of the tips that a server will make. And so, you know, when the industry says nobody actually earns $2.13 an hour, these are well-paid tipped workers, well, there is a segment of the population for whom that's true. There are these wealthy white servers. I won't even say wealthy, actually. I will say better paid white servers who work in fine dining restaurants, and they should be paid a livable wage. They should be remunerated for the professional work that they do. This is a profession. It's a skilled profession as it's recognized to be in other countries. But a big part of the problem is that people of color are not able to actually get to those great livable wage fine dining server and bartending positions. Those jobs are not accessible to the vast majority of workers in this industry. So we need to do two things. We need to lift the floor by eliminating the lower wage for tipped workers and raising the wage overall for everybody. And we need to build the ladder. We need to lift the floor and build the ladder so that while we're lifting the floor, we also create much better ability for workers to move into continuously higher paying positions, especially fine dining server and bartending positions, which can be family supporting jobs.
The fight to increase the minimum wage has been one of the most vibrant and visible labor struggles in recent years and has been recognized by corporate media as an unapologetic, creative campaign that encourages us to see that workers are consumers and vice versa. But while media cover activism, their serious talk about raising the wage is still dogged by old myths, preeminent among them that a higher minimum wage would hurt business, especially small business. Holly Sklar told Counterspin how her group, Business for a Fair Minimum Wage, gives the lie to that line.
There's a big misunderstanding that there needs to be some kind of a split between business and workers on raising the minimum wage or on the economics of it. But in fact, we think, and we are a national network of business owners and executives and business alliances who do believe a fair minimum wage makes good business sense. In general, we know that it's absolutely the case that you cannot build a strong economy on a falling wage floor, and the minimum wage adjusted for the cost of living has fallen dramatically. At the federal level, $7.25 is actually lower, adjusted for inflation, than the minimum wage of 1950, and it's a third lower than 1968. And so you cannot build a strong economy, and you cannot really build a strong business for the long haul on falling real wages. Most businesses in the country are small businesses, and so by definition, most of our members are small businesses, although we have some very large businesses as well. And we have business alliances, for example, the Greater New York Chamber of Commerce, which represents about 30,000 business supports raising minimum wage. Small businesses understand very well that workers are also consumers. If there's not enough money in the wage base of the economy of the people that they're hoping will come in and buy their goods and services, they feel it every day. And they also feel very directly what it's like to have a worker who, if they're underpaid, if they're not really earning enough to even keep a roof overhead, put food on the table, buy the winter jacket of a growing kid, they're distracted by this financial stress that's continual. And so they believe very strongly that the workers should earn enough so that they can focus on the business, on the customer, and not be constantly worried about just how are they going to make ends meet, how are they going to make the rent, and so on. My point is that's a big myth that has been sold. I mean, if cutting wages and cutting benefits and cutting just this whole notion that the more you can squeeze out of the worker at the same time as in the giant corporation, not the small businesses, but in the bigger corporation, you go in the exact opposite way and you have more and more of the revenue of the company going to fewer and fewer hands at the top. You know, we've already tested that. That's my point, that model is delivering us worse economic growth. That model is giving us a shrinking middle class, and that model is what produced the greatest economic meltdown since the Great Depression. There's nothing theoretical about that. We have seen what this business model and this economic model produces, and it's terrible. It's terrible for workers, and it's also terrible for most businesses. The biggest thing businesses have complained about in recent years is that they're just not seeing enough consumer demand. They're not seeing enough consumer buying power. They need more. You know, you need people to buy what they're making in order to sustain the business and to grow the business. And there's obviously a direct connection, or I say obviously, but the folks like Donald Trump who doesn't, you know, ideologically they don't want to see it as obvious. You need people to have enough wages to be able to buy what they need. And if you're going to have a growing middle class, you need people to be able to buy more than just the bare necessities, right? And that's what we've lost sight of.
Media lose sight of the struggles of working people and how they figure in the economy, in good part because they so rarely listen at any length with any degree of seriousness to working people. It can be hard to get big media to tell labor's story, even when it's their own story. Professor Aviva Chomsky told us about the labor disruption by newspaper deliverers at the Boston Globe.
I think a lot of people still have in mind that newspapers are delivered by 12-year-olds on their bicycles, and that's not how it is at all anymore. Newspaper delivery has become big business, and it's done through an elaborate system of subcontracting, and the people who deliver the newspapers are adults. They do it by car, and their routes are far longer and more complex than what the kids in the neighborhoods used to do. So newspaper delivery is a job that's done through subcontracting. It's a 365-day-a-year job. It has to be done in the middle of the night from about 2 a.m. until 6 a.m., no matter what the weather, what the conditions. And it's a job that's extremely poorly paid. That is, you have to have your own car, your own insurance. You have to drive hundreds of miles a week. But you're not considered an employee. You're considered an independent contractor. And therefore, the employer, which is the subcontractor, who is contracted by the newspaper, doesn't have any of the responsibilities that an employer has. They don't have to pay you minimum wage. They don't have to give you unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, Social Security. They get out of all their responsibilities as an employer.
Right.
And not surprisingly, this is an area of the economy where a lot of the people who work there are immigrants and a significant number are also undocumented, because it's designed to be a sort of a hidden underground piece of the economy. So that's how it's been. But then the Boston Globe decided they wanted to make it even cheaper for themselves, and they contracted out to a new delivery company that promised to give them a lower rate. And basically the only way to get a lower rate is to pay your workers even less. And there is something just a little bit ironic about this whole situation, that this is the newspaper, this is the people who are supposed to be doing the investigation and bringing the news, and that they're relying on this very hidden system of distribution.
The deliverers went out for a month, and someone had the idea to have Globe reporters deliver the Sunday paper, leading to a round of fish-out-of-water stories, but not much else.
It's not just the Boston Globe reporters, but this story was picked up nationally, so it was in the New York Times. That is, the fact that Boston Globe reporters spent one night doing what immigrant workers do 365 days a year, that suddenly made national news. So NPR, as you said, the New York Times, Columbia Journalism Review, it was popping up everywhere, this amazing fact that newspaper reporters spent a night delivering the paper. And I'm surprised that no one was sort of embarrassed to acknowledge just how big this divide is and how unlikely and shocking it was that something like this could happen, that newspaper reporters could actually see how the paper gets delivered. There were a couple of Globe reporters who really did try to get under the surface, and I have to especially give a shout out to Marcela Garcia, who's one of the few Globe reporters who actually speaks Spanish, which helped a lot, who actually interviewed some of the workers there. But most of the Boston Globe's reporting and the national level reporting ignored the workers completely. That is, it told the story about how the Boston Globe workers went out, but the emphasis was that the whole problem was software. That is, that the new company had inadequate software. So it tried to go sort of from one extreme of the reality of the grittiness and the exploitation involved in this actual physical labor and turn it into something technological and computerized and further invisibilizing the workers who actually do the work.
The people who do the work are often invisible in corporate news media, even as their beliefs, feelings, and motivations are debated by well-heeled pundits and politicians. When Counterspin spoke with labor journalist Mike Elk a few years back, a number of pundits were contending that U.S. media snobbishly overlook the country's heartland, which it turns out they thought meant NASCAR and conservatism. We asked Elk his thoughts on that and on labor coverage in general.
I mean, I grew up in Appalachia. I think Bible Belt conservatism is much different than anybody thinks. I mean, I started union organizing in West Virginia, and guys would show up to meetings with Bush Cheney stickers on the bumper stickers, and then they'd be talking about needing to go on a strike. So it's a complex issue, and I think the way that people like Chuck Todd present it is just unreal. But, you know, take a great story. Pew studies show, this was in 2009. In 2009, only 2% of those quoted on stories about economics were union members, despite union members making up 12% of the population. This is incredible. I mean, the largest organized group of workers only being quoted in 2% of stories. But I think covering the labor movement, people often come up with ideas of how to revive the labor movement. And it typically is this bizarre debate where if labor just gets this message right, they'll somehow revive the labor movement. It completely ignores the fact that there's more than enough enthusiasm in this country for the labor movement. polls show that the majority of people in this country would join a union if they can. The problem is the barriers, the people getting fired on their jobs and things like that. Only one out of six union drives ever results in a contract. So the big barriers are how do you get people to risk everything? How do you get people to stick together? What are the smart strategies that people are able to do to get that kind of momentum? And then how do they take on a company? And that's something you don't get. I was thinking about one of the first big labor struggles I ever visited. When I was about 7 years old, I went down to Ravenswood, West Virginia. And those guys down there, they were locked out for about a year and a half. And they came up with a plan to go all over the world and track down eventually the owner of the company, which was Mark Rich, a financier who was in exile in Switzerland because he had sold goods to Iran in violation of the embargo, as well as tax evasion, wire fraud, a number of other things. And they shook him down, a bunch of rednecks from West Virginia. I mean, they went over to Switzerland and they formed ties with the Swiss labor movement, and then they were able to put some pressure on him in Switzerland so that he thought he was going to get kicked out of Switzerland. And that's an incredible story. Where do people come up with that desire to, instead of just give up and make a separate deal, to actually do something? And I think that's a really big question. And that, almost all labor coverage doesn't get covered. It becomes this elite debate about, you know, how do unions strike the right message? We already have the right message. It's how do we come over with the boss? How do we get good contracts? How do we do smart campaigns?
That was labor journalist Mike Elk. Before that, we heard Aviva Chomsky, Holly Sklar, Saru Jayaraman, Bruce Stanley, and Scott Nova. And that's it for this special Labor Day Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
In these wild and confusing times, I look hard for wise heads to help guide us. We want someone not so dedicated to the power system that they just lull us with sweet propaganda. And we want sources not so far out that they baffle us with twisted facts. And I think our next guest may fill that sweet spot in between. Now, outside the official United Nations climate press conferences at Lima and Paris, we got other voices, powerful voices, through a group I knew little about. It's called the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. Is it reliable? Wait until you hear who's involved. Here are just a few of the many founding members: James Hansen, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Carrie Emanuel, Catherine Hayhoe, Rabbi David Rosen, Swami Saraswati, Michael Mann, Reverend Sally Bingham, Michael Oppenheimer. The list goes on and on. So often chairing these high-powered press conferences in different cities, all recorded as YouTube videos, is Stuart Scott. He's the founder and director of strategic planning for the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. Stuart Scott, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me on the show. I'm really quite honored.
Well, later, I'd like to find out how you drew together so many top scientists and spiritual leaders into a strong climate alliance. But would you mind, Stuart, if we start first with some of the most pressing problems for our listeners?
I start wherever you like. I have real confidence in the shows that you put together. So,
okay. Well, now, a month ago, I gave a heads up to our listeners that the economic system is teetering on the edge even more than usual. And that's a hard one. We don't want to suffer. We don't want our loved ones and neighbors to suffer. Yet, if we keep going with this fossil-powered heat engine we call civilization, we will wreck the climate if we haven't done it already. Do you think an economic crash could be a real way to slash emissions quickly?
Well, that's a really good place to start. Let me segue into answering it kind of laterally. For me, the climate problem is one of an array of ecological problems and environmental problems that we have. We have more than just those. We have a huge problem of inequity, where you're well known, 1% to 1% richest people make more than 80% of the poorest people. But the specifics of the ecological crisis that we're going through, of which climate is the leading edge, is a direct result of a what I call a defective operating system for global civilization. And that operating system is known conventionally by two names, money and economics. Now, the economics part, the brand of economics we have is a particular brand. It's growth economics. It's actually called neoclassical growth economics. And after 100 years of only having that, people have kind of become used to it as the only game in town, or the only possibility even. It's the only thing we can conceive of. Well, it's not. And unless we change our economic folly very quickly, and it will change on its own if we don't do so of our own volition, unless we can manage to change this rapacious economic system in a way that it will function in harmony with the planet rather than devouring the planet, we are looking at a collapse of civilization, as far as I can tell. Climate, as I say, is just the leading edge. We have plenty of other scales of ecological health or unhealth of the planet that are similarly being violated. You know, the nitrogen cycle, the water cycle, phosphorus, various key elements which are on all of these dimensions, we are reaching problem territory. But climate, as I say, is the leading edge. It's the one that's going to impact us quickly. So to get back to your question, not only would an economic, let's say, mildly an economic downturn, notice how the growth economists always want to frame any kind of degrowth, any kind of contraction of the economy as bad, and we'll be getting back to growth again soon, folks, so just stay tuned and keep buying, go out there and buy. So unless we have a sustained leveling off, if not downturn, then we will have an economic crash. And I view that economic crash as pulling us back from an ecological crash, which is even far more dangerous. The economic crash, as you kind of said, it'll be bad for people's well-being and health and livelihood, and the banks will foreclose. And we know what it'll look like. The way the system is set up, economic downturns, the banks are the only agencies that make out. But if we have the kind of climate future that many scientists are saying we're headed directly and quickly towards, then it's going to be a loss of easily half the population of Earth. And I say half the population when I say that to many people I interact with. They say, oh, if we get off easy, it'll be only half. Wow. So we're talking about very, very serious dimensions here.
Well, my other concern about an economic crash is it may freeze us into our current energy system. You know, the electric grid that wastes half of all the power produced, the old coal and nuclear plants will stick with them. What if there is no money to transition to a clean energy system?
There are arguments that could be made in both directions there, and it's one of those we're not quite sure until we cross that bridge, until we see what, if we get the big downturn, the collapse, the slowdown, what the response is. But there are individuals and organizations, corporations, who are hell-bent on impeding the transition to renewables, to less impactful sources of energy, no matter what. No matter what. So I'm not sure that the downturn, when the lack of capital, will be the main problem.
Let's talk a little bit about China. Economic pundits used to say demand from rising China would rejuvenate growth in the world, and you've outlined the point that we really just can't take a lot more growth in the way we look at it. Well, now it comes, there's a bit of a slump in China, a rocky stock market there. Stuart Scott, where do you think China fits into our struggle to avoid dangerous climate change?
Well, it's a very good question. China is the game changer globally. Their economy quickly, over the past couple of decades, grew to rival that of the United States. And I'm not sure if it's now a bigger economy than the American economy. But, of course, the two are interwoven, so to say who's bigger is it's not very relevant. They are both simultaneously growing big for the same reasons. But China has the political advantage, and I'm sure a lot of people in America and the so-called world of democracy will take exception to this. China has the advantage of not having an easily manipulated bi-party or multi-party system. And I say easily manipulated because as smart as we think we are, it is fairly easy to manipulate a population and get them to vote one way or another. It's like presidential contests in the U.S. have become more a question of who's got more money to spend, whose PR guys are better. You know, we've seen some presidents sold into office who we scratch our heads, wonder how they got there. And in fact, now a lot of people say that about some of the current candidates, and I won't mention names because I try to stay politically neutral. It's difficult, especially when one party in the U.S. aligns itself more or less with denial that climate is a problem. In any case, China having a single party, which is all-powerful, can turn on a dime. I was told that when China wanted to do away with disposable plastic bags, they hired 450,000 inspectors to go bust shop and shopkeepers who were still giving out free plastic bags. So China can turn on a dime when it wants to. Now, I am working with James Hansen this year since he responded positively to my invitation to come to COP21. And that was actually the first COP, the first conference of parties to the Kyoto Protocols that he ever attended. I'm hoping that he and I will have a closer working relationship this year. But his information to me in one of our emails was that China is where the change will happen this year. China is where the action will be. And I believe what he means is that China has the need, the ability, the financial resources to turn to renewable sources of energy very quickly. And he is inside of their thinking to some degree. He just got back from a trip to China that he went to after Paris talks were over. So his assessment was made after his return to the U.S. from that trip. So China, I think we're going to see them turning the quickest and hopefully setting the way. And also, they will be eating our lunch, continuing to eat our lunch in terms of developing of the renewable energy infrastructure. And I mean, they're the leading supplier of solar panels now, and we'll probably follow that up with all kinds of large-scale and small-scale alternative energy implementations.
Well, I don't want to pour cold lunch on that, but I do know that Dr. James Hansen is also very strongly advocating nuclear energy, and that the Chinese are building, I believe, at least 29 new nuclear plants. Yes, they're leading in wind. Yes, they're leading in solar, but they're also going heavily nuclear, and that worries me, especially after Fukushima.
The nuclear question is one that I have to deal with very deftly, because it is a very hot-button topic for good reasons. Humanity has lots of hubris, and we don't have a very good track record at containing anything, no less something that needs to be contained for a quarter of a million years or so. So, yes, I have traditionally had great reservations about nuclear power. But Dr. Hansen got together with three other well-known scientists in Paris and did a press conference. And I actually helped publicize the press conference. I'm not ashamed of that at all. And what they're talking about, what these four scientists went on record as saying, is that we will not be able to make the turn away from what I will call certain death, the continuation of greenhouse gas emissions unabated, unless we allow nuclear to be in the mix. And they are not talking about the old-style nuclear. They're talking about what's called fourth-generation nuclear, which is not ready for commercial deployment now. I'll be honest, as far as I know, it's not. There are two forms, and the one that I know of is called liquid thorium. It has a small footprint in terms of the amount of space it takes. It actually digests the conventional nuclear waste from the old style of power plant, making it non-fissible, that is non-bomb-making material, a much smaller amount of it, much shorter half-life. So it's, in many respects, it's a solution to problems we've created with the first couple of generations of nuclear power. So I'm not going to hold myself out as a proponent. I'm kind of the messenger, so don't shoot the messenger. But from gentlemen who are very, very studied about the trends and problems from a macro level, they don't see us dodging the bullet unless we allow nuclear to be in the mix. Now, Dr. Hansen did say that there's a quasi-religious opposition to nuclear power that is unhelpful. I would just urge people to consider all the facts and not just go with a knee-jerk reaction.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that, because I want to move on to another hot topic, and that's the possibility of abrupt climate change. Your group, the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative, helped our guest and climate scientist Paul Beckwith get that information out at COP meetings. Do you personally think abrupt climate change is a serious risk? And if so, what could happen?
Well, yes, and the short answer is yes, I think it's a very serious risk. Now, I look at our futures in a more nuanced fashion, in that I kind of constantly am factoring the risk of something happening times the severity of what will occur if it does happen. And that helps me determine my priority list of what I want to work on, what needs to be paid attention to. And I think it's a serious enough risk that we should be treating it as though it were imminent. Because if it is real, and there are some very credible scientists, besides Paul Beckwith, who's become a good friend in the last couple of years, there's Dr. Peter Wadhams, Dr. Natalia Shakova, and others, Dr. Jason Box, others who have gone up to the northern latitudes of the planet, the Arctic zones, and observed methane releases. And methane is the showstopper. Methane is the gun going off. If there is a methane burp, as it's been called, if there's a huge sustained methane release, as there appears to be underway, then that could be just the game over signal. So we need to treat that with, I think, all due haste. And I believe that there should be research going on to how do we artificially pull the northern regions of the planet, the Arctic zone of the planet. And that brings up another quasi-religious hot button, which is the G word, not the God word, the geoengineering word, because people, rightly so, question our ability to get it right. We have geoengineered our way into this mess. What do you think? Hundreds of millions of cars and trucks running around on stored sunlight in the form of carbon fuels. What do you think that is? That's geoengineering. We just geoengineered our way into the problem without calling it that, without knowing it was that. So that's the paradigm. We are geoengineering the planet. The question is, can we come up with a wiser way of geoengineering our way out of the mess that we've created?
Lots of debate on that. Moving on again, well-respected scientists like James Hansen and Peter Ward warned that rising seas will be the first and worst big impact of climate change. Do you think it could be something else?
Yes, I don't think that. That's one place where I disagree with Dr. Hansen. He, by the way, to be fair, he is somewhat dismissive about the situation with the Arctic methane. You'd have to class him as one of the modelers. And the expeditionary scientists who go up there and see the methane happening and measure it in the water column, they say, come and look. But the modelers say, well, our models say that it can't be happening yet. So there's a standoff there, and I can't begin to resolve that one. But I think there's a huge cause for concern there. Hopefully, I'll be able to get Dr. Hansen to maybe go up and do some observations himself and see whether that changes his position on the methane release.
And what about the whole issue of the threat to our food production? We've seen a mini edition of that in California with the drought and food prices going up because of it. But, you know, as the world warms, this could get much, much worse.
Yes, I'm sorry. I lost the thread of your previous question. Thanks for essentially leading me back to it. I don't think rising sea levels is the worst that we face. I think that food shortages, collapse of our ability to grow food in certain regions, certain nations, will be the worst that we face. Because when people get hungry, governments fall. It is said by many that the war in Syria, which was capitalized upon by ISIS, they took political control in a power, not vacuum, but a power contest between the government that was not taking care of its people when they were experiencing the trouble with their extended drought and their crop failures. We will be seeing this more and more and more. There's a set of four maps that I show whenever I do my presentations about climate, which show your audience can find them online by Googling University Corporation for Atmospheric Research, and they had four predictive drought maps. Well, actually, one was for the first decade, and then it was the one-third, two-third, and final decade of this century. And they are mind-blowing as to what's predicted by conservative science in terms of the drying out of huge areas of the planet. And it looks like, at least from the rainfall perspective, that the northern latitudes of China, Russia, and Canada will be where most of the food will have to come from by the end of this century, by the latter third of this century. But the soils there are not well-developed soils because those have been perennially frozen land. So you've got thin soil, which will be getting adequate rain and will probably be inadequate to feed a population of 7 to 9 billion people. I think we're looking at a collapse of human population in this century.
Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Stuart Scott, founder of the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. Stuart, are you a scientist? What is your background?
Well, my background, I'm well-trained in many sciences. I'm not an expert. I don't hold myself out to be an expert, but I graduated from Columbia University with a wide training in physics and chemistry and biology. But I specialized in mathematics. I taught mathematics and statistics and critical thinking at the college level for several years before I literally quit my day job to do climate work full time. So I look at trends, I evaluate things with a critical eye, and I try to discern what are the most important trends and facts of all that I look at and study, and what's the most reliable, who's saying what, and how many people are of credibility are agreeing and disagreeing. I come up with a synthesis of my own that then I combine with my other skills, which I seem to have a skill at public presentation. I go out and make these presentations about the climate problem, and that over the years has led me to a more and more refined strategy on how do I make change? How do I try to create the change in the direction that I feel we need, because I have no particular fortune or fame to work with. And that's actually how I came up with this United Planet Faith and Science Initiative, realizing that I could make the best contribution by focusing the authority of others on the problem I felt we had.
How did you manage to do that? You've got some tremendous names involved.
Well, it actually came out of a 2009 project, which literally it emerged from my meditation. You know, it was a spiritual inspiration. I all of a sudden, in a moment, saw intact what I had to do. And I called it the Interfaith Declaration on Climate Change. And a friend who I'd met at one of the lesser climate talks in Bonn, Germany, he and I wrote a one-page document called that, the Interfaith Declaration on Climate Change. And because I had this epiphany of sorts where I realized that while you can describe the problem in terms of physics, greenhouse gases, whatnot, that the cause was we were trying to fill an inner lack with stuff, with trips and vacations and iPods and iPads and whatnot. And that actually, if we were happier with ourselves, we might be less into consuming things and there might be less of a problem. Of course, we have a system where those appetites are provoked by advertising constantly. That's the basis of this defective operating system, as I call it. But I realized that there was a valid place for trying to address the climate problem through the auspices of spiritual leaders. And it turned out that I would always have a scientist present when I did one of these events. And then I realized that science was a necessary member of the party, needed a seat at the table, and that actually we were looking at a consensus of not just all religious leaders. And when have you known religious leaders of many different faiths to agree on things? Well, here we have a huge consensus amongst all the faiths on the climate problem, and that consensus is shared by science. Well, this is kind of remarkable. And so I changed the name from Interfaith Declaration and changed it to United Planet, as in United Nations Erase the Borders, United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. And I called it initiative at the recommendation of one of our founding members, who said if you're anything else but an initiative, then you will be perceived as competition by other interfaith organizations. So you want to be perceived as something that will come and go away. You're not competing for donations or dollars. So we are an initiative, the Faith and Science Initiative. And we put it out to widely to the spiritual community and to scientists, and we got a very, very good response. So it is a very deeply felt homage to both the camps of science and spirituality. And the overlap, because there is an overlap. There are individuals who see no problem, no contradiction between one and the other.
Well, that can be a problem, though, because I know some of our listeners become suspicious as soon as they hear religion is involved. Others might embrace it. But there has been a long history of religion denying, even suppressing science. We're still seeing it in the U.S. Congress off and on. So why should we trust the voices of religions now on this critical issue?
You know, everybody's got to answer that for themselves when it comes down to it. But a good start before you start answering those deep questions is to try to put aside preconceptions. Shall we say, there's been a long history, and I'm not picking on one religion, but there's been a long history within the Catholic religion of all kinds of, I think we could agree, negative things. People burned at the stake and the Inquisition. So there have been wars that have come out of the Vatican when the Vatican actually maintained an army in the Middle Ages or before. But then does one therefore throw out all of the wonderful lobbying effort that Pope Francis has been doing this year because of the historical painting, shall we say, of prior popes who did things that were not so good? I think we owe it to ourselves and we owe it to our children and this moment in time. We owe it to humanity and life on earth to take a very clear look and put aside our preconceptions. Which is, you know, we have to start looking at reality and not looking at our beliefs if we're going to avoid the worst that's coming at us.
Well, now, this question could involve faith or maybe mass psychology, but I think many of us are hoping there will be a big spark, a big change. Do you think humans can shift quickly from their current state of apathy and denial into action? Are there social tipping points?
Yes, I do believe in that. Revolutions come from social tipping points. I'm not proposing revolution in this case, but revolutionary thinking often comes from very innocuous events. The Arab Spring is said to have arisen from one particular food vendor whose cart was impounded by the police, burning himself alive in front of police headquarters, if I'm not mistaken, in Tunisia. One event, one person's martyring himself, and I'm obviously not recommending, you know, as we say jokingly, kids don't try this at home. I like to make the quote, the famous quote of Margaret Mead, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, concerned citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. And every time I say that, I'm brought to tears because I think that's what we need. I think we need people to get motivated and not to feel powerless and to actually take action.
Stuart Scott, I said at the outset that your organization records powerful speakers you attract and you post those videos on YouTube. Please tell us about a couple of, that you have available and where we can find them.
Yes, thank you. The United Planet Faith and Science Initiative, I'll call it my baby, sort of, we cooked up something that is now called climatematters.tv. This came out of the press conferences I did in Lima last year and in Bonn, Germany earlier in 2015 before Paris. I, instead of doing it a standard press conference, talking to the audience, talking to the press, I did it. I tried to reform it as a TV show, TV talk show, and it worked well in Bonn in June. And then we visited in Paris and did 11 of these that were quite successful. So I would urge people to go to climatematters.tv. And the very first one, I'm just posting it today. It will be presentable by the time your listeners go to climatematters.tv. The very first one in the upper left corner is a pet project called, well, it's a Nobel Peace Prize. I took time in several of my Climate Matters shows in Paris to do a non-commercial break, an analog of the usual commercial breaks in ordinary TV. But this was a pitch for something that I was giving away, a Nobel Peace Prize for sustainable development. And I would urge your listeners to go to NP4SD.org. That is Nobel Prize for Sustainable Development in an acronym, NP4SD.org. And take a look at the Nobel Peace Prize we're proposing there, which would be a game changer. And we have reason to believe that it's got a good chance if a lot of people do the endorsement, public endorsement, and qualified nominations.
Well, finally, Stuart, I want to put you on the same spot where I find myself pretty well every day. Can we arrange what we have into a better world, or do we first have to pass through a dark portal where much is destroyed before we can get to a new beginning? What do you think?
I'll have to say all of the above. That is, I do believe we can, but it would take a tremendous act of will. It would take something on the order of a second coming. It would take some leader or some charismatic voice or some event for people to really straighten up quickly. I think it's possible. I don't think it's probable. I think we will have to go through some difficult times, and I'm just hopeful that we don't set off what is known as runaway climate change, which might conceivably condemn humanity to extinction. That's a possibility.
Well, I guess that's where faith comes in. We've been talking with Stuart Scott. He's founded an organization which counts some of the world's top climate scientists and religious leaders among its members. It's called the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. You can follow links in my Radio EcoShock blog, which is published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info, and I'll have a whole bunch of those videos there, plus how to get to United Planet's site. Stuart, thank you so much for supporting the voices that we do need to hear and for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Hello, I'm David Koch.
And I'm Charles Koch.
And we're the Koch brothers.
You might know us just as a couple of chill guys who own the Republican Party. But what you may not know is that there's a major problem plaguing our society. Idiots who claim that climate change is real. Folks, climate change is pure fiction. So we spent billions of dollars assembling the world's hottest conservative pop stars to sing a song that we wrote. We hope it proves to you that climate change is hogwash. Enjoy!
Long ago, droughts were super common. Earthquakes happened often, and it rained a ton.
Nowadays, rivers are still rushing,
waterfalls are gushing, and snow exists.
Don't believe the lies you hear,
that the end of time's near.
Liberals are twisting facts, it's a big conspiracy.
That's a clip from the Climate Change Deniers Anthem, created by the comedy group Funny or Die. Watch the whole video at funnyordie.com or chase the link in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
In the media, all we see or hear are relatively wealthy people talking amongst ourselves. Billions of global poor are missing. Many of them are women. Our guest Betsy Teutsch has collected earth-friendly ideas and tech to help them. Her new book is 100 Under $100, 100 Ideas for Empowering Global Women. From Philadelphia, Betsy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Well, you know, I've traveled in the developed world and briefly underdeveloped world, I guess we could say, and briefly witnessed deep poverty in several countries. Yet I feel isolated from that, and I'm almost unable to find language to describe it. Who are the global poor, and how can we talk about them?
Well, one way of talking about them is to say the bottom of the pyramid or the base of the pyramid, people that live on a couple dollars a day. But that doesn't mean much to people in the affluent world because the dollar goes much further in poor countries. So the way that I like to think about it is that these are people that live in low resource regions. They're poor, but they're also missing a lot of the infrastructure that we take for granted. So not only do they have to live on a really meager income, but they are lacking water provision. They're lacking sanitation, waste management. They're lacking an electrical grid. They're by definition off-grid, not because they're hippies, but because there's no electricity and they have to patch it together with things like single-use batteries, because you can't charge batteries if you don't have electricity. So they live in a life that's full of poverty traps. It's expensive to be poor. They're also missing transportation grid and municipal services. Many of the global poor now live in expanding slums around the world. We call them shanty towns or favelas. They've moved from remote villages to cities, but they're called para-urban slums. They don't have municipal services. That would be even education and police. So people are just left to fend for themselves.
Okay, so in India, the woman often runs the household purse, and in Africa, I've heard that women do most of the work. Is that why you chose to focus on women, per se, or were there other reasons?
The reason I focused on women is that I have really fallen in love with what we call humanitarian technology. There was a great book about 10 years ago called Design for the Other 90%. The way that really cleverly designed, durable, attractive, affordable tools can really make a big difference. One of the things that I have in the book is called Solar Ear, and it's a very inexpensive, very effective hearing aid, and it uses solar charging batteries. Because even if you could give a poor person, one of these extremely poor people, a hearing aid, how would they ever be able to afford the batteries? So something like that is so smart, and it just, I love that kind of design. But I noticed when in the various women's empowerment organizations that I've worked with, schools for girls and funding grassroots organizations that are women's empowerment initiatives, they seem very technology shy. And that reflects the gender divide that you see in technology generally. It's sort of a male domain. In a patriarchy, men literally are the technology gatekeepers. So part of the challenge is that you have to get to the women directly. so that they can understand how the technology and these better tools will help them improve their lives. They're already working incredibly hard. So the goal is to get them access to tools so that they can help themselves. You can't just give people these tools. People don't want things that you just give them. We have to create demand. So I figured by focusing on women, that would be the way to unleash a lot of interest in this subject. Women are very effective tools for development. We know that. Educating girls is the most impactful thing you can do for an economy.
Right. Well, you know, reading your work, it seems like any one of these 100 ideas could become a movement in itself. I mean, just the type of stoves that you've found, and it could go viral. Is that starting to happen, do you think?
Well, I'm not getting any feeling that in the talks in Paris that poverty is on the agenda. Although I have Bill Gates is talking about getting people out of poverty and, you know, keeping our planet habitable. But when we talk about the big fight seems to be over coal, you know, coal-powered plants and that sort of thing, and that kind of energy provision doesn't do anything for the poor because they're never going to have transmission lines. They're never going to be able to get access to that kind of energy. That will benefit businesses. It'll benefit the economy more generally, but it won't get down to the household level. So I really want to focus on how a household in the developing world could improve quality of life and actually lower their carbon footprint. People don't pay too much attention to the globally poor because, relatively speaking, their carbon footprint is tiny relative to, say, my house in Philadelphia where I live. But there are 3 million households where we could have a huge impact by making sure that people can get solar power, for example. But we're not talking about a solar array of 30 panels. We're talking about one or two panels having a huge impact.
Right. It could provide light for people, including girls, to study at night or get some schooling in or get some extra work done. It's hard to think that in some places when it gets dark, well, it's dark.
Yeah. And people are using kerosene lamps. And kerosene is really smoky. It's a fossil fuel. One of the dirty secrets, literally dirty, is that many governments subsidize kerosene. So they make it cheap and affordable. But it's still a really inferior light, and it's very smelly. It has a lot of toxic fumes that are bad for the planet, but they're really bad for the household. They call it indoor air pollution. It causes a lot of respiratory disease and eye problems and fire hazards. So getting rid of kerosene would be a major improvement for everybody and the planet. And the thing is, a solar light that will replace a kerosene lamp, there's even one on the market called the No-Kero light, and that stands for no kerosene. They're very inexpensive now because they use LEDs. LEDs need very little power. They're very efficient. They're hyper-efficient, really. So the lamps now only cost about $10 or $15, and people can actually pay for their own solar lamp by no longer having to purchase kerosene, even subsidized kerosene. So many of these upgrades pay for themselves. It's a question of getting systems in place and people informed.
Now, you mentioned Paris. People like Bjorn Lomborg say we shouldn't bother spending money on alternative energy or reducing carbon emissions. He thinks global poverty is more important. Do we have to choose between the two, Betsy?
Well, that's the thing. We don't. We can do it together. And people, there's sort of a false impression that what we're going to do is expand the kind of infrastructures that we have in the affluent world to the developing world. And that would be incredibly stupid because they're inefficient and poorly designed. It's just that that's what we have and they work for us. But why would we want to replicate them? A great example is our sewage system. We take all this waste, we call it waste, and we treat it and flush it and spend so much energy getting rid of it, and then we discharge it into the water. But there's a whole movement in the developing world and also off-grid called eco-sanitation, and essentially it captures the assets that are in waste. If they call it poop power, whatever, to be, you know, graphic. and it becomes manure. It becomes humanure, some people call it. It becomes fertilizer. It becomes a soil amendment. But you're capturing it. Also, if you use a biodigester, which you can use animal waste, vegetable waste, human waste, you put it all in there, and it's anaerobic, and it basically is sort of a, like it's a composter, except much faster. And it breaks down into biogas, so you can fuel a stove, say, just out of, you pipe it right out of the biodigester. It's like a landfill, I guess, same idea. And then you have organic fertilizer. So that's the kind of infrastructure that we should be building in the developing world to provide waste sanitation for people, not flush toilets and sewers. That just, A, it's impossible. If you've ever been in one of those favelas, you see that you can't just go add pipes. There's no space.
Exactly.
And it's prohibitive. So what we have to do, the fact that we're missing infrastructure in all of these para-urban slums is actually a huge opportunity to redo things and to redesign them so that they're much more eco-friendly and much more sustainable.
Okay, Betsy Teutsch, what is your fantasy package of tools we need to improve the lives of poor women and their families?
Well, I do dream of this. If we could get each household a small solar panel, doesn't have to be a big one anymore because they're so much more efficient. A relatively small one can be a starter. Then they can add, they already have cell phones by and large. More people have cell phones than toilets in the world, a surprising statistic to a lot of people. And then they can get lights and they can charge their cell phone and their lights from the solar panel, and eventually a lot of people are going to have computers and tablets. They're going to just leapfrog right over having televisions because they can go straight to having a screen that is connected through some sort of Wi-Fi to programming. They need to have some kind of water purification. There's a wonderful product on the market called the Solvatten. It was designed in Sweden. That's Swedish for sun water, and it's basically a big black suitcase that you fill with water, you open it, and you do solar water purification. It takes only about 2 hours. There's a gauge right on it that tells you when your water is ready, and it's so hot that it can double as a hot water heater. If you plant a few trees around people's homes, then you have all kinds of eco-benefits, and they could be fruit trees. The moringa tree is incredibly quick-growing, and it has all kinds of health benefits. You can eat the leaves. Everybody calls it kind of the magic tree. So if you just did a couple of those things, you had a biodigester. They have a balloon style that's much smaller for a household, or a composting toilet so that they could safely have the benefits of separating their waste stream from their water stream. That would be huge. And then you get them an improved cook stove or a combination of cooking techniques so that they're not having to go out and girls collecting wood, which they spend hours a day doing that, and it is deforesting. So you can then let the forest regenerate. So a simple package like that, which is probably just a few hundred dollars, and the family itself can pay for it in savings and improved productivity, would do an immense amount towards shrinking carbon footprints and increasing carbon sequestration. It's amazing how much, there's something called black carbon, which is what is produced when people cook over open fires. They're incredibly inefficient. And from what I have read, black carbon is just a technical name for soot and particulates. And it creates kind of a blanket. It's not technically a fossil fuel, but it does stay around, and it's very damaging to the environment. So get rid of all those carbon soot providers, and we'd have a much healthier air quality.
Yeah, it kills millions of people just from cooking inside with open fires, as you describe, and that soot is traveling up to glaciers in the Himalayas and darkening them, causing them to melt faster, and even makes it all the way up to the Arctic, where I've seen pictures of Greenland that's it's now gray land because of the soot that has arrived there from around the world. And then you have this great big cloud forms over India for part of the year and over China that takes away up to 10% of the sun's power. So stoves, incredibly important, and new ways to do that.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Betsy Teutsch. We're talking about her collection of 100 ideas under $100 to empower global women. Betsy, what about population concerns? Are we really post-peak child? That's a new idea for me. What does that mean?
Well, Hans Rosling, who has this wonderful website, Gapminder, is a brilliant Norwegian, and his field, he's an epidemiologist, I believe. His field is visualizing data. And he shows that statistically we're post-peak child. We peaked at the number of babies born a couple of years ago, and nobody knows this, it seems. The number of births per mother has just plummeted over one generation. In Mexico, I think it's dropped from 5 to 2 per mother, just as an example. And that's as a combination of better family planning, but it's also educating girls. When you can keep girls in school and then they can go on to secondary school, high school, they postpone the age of marriage. They're more employable. And then they can get jobs. They contribute to the economy. That's the whole Pacific Rim miracle. And they delay fertility. And then when they educated women have many fewer children. That's a fact that we know around the world. So there's about a 200 million women gap in family planning. So if we met that gap, we could get there even faster. But the increase, we're still going to be experiencing a huge population increase. But it's not because more kids are being born. It's because the kids that were born ahead of them are aging, and life expectancy is increasing. So it's all those extra people that were born in the 70s, 80s, 90s, zeros, all those people aging. But eventually, the predictions are that we will max out at, I think, around 11 billion is the prediction, and then we'll start to gradually taper off. So, of course, a baby born in an affluent part of the world consumes much more than a baby born in the low-income parts of the world because there's only so much people can consume. But it's good news. It, obviously, if there are fewer people than we thought there might be, the predictions when I was, I'm in my 60s, the predictions when I was in high school when Paul Ehrlich was talking about the population bomb, that did not come to be. It's actually much better news than anybody expected. And it's all about educating women.
Well, yes and no. I mean, 11 billion people on this planet to me is a catastrophe. We've got 7 billion now, and we're using up much more than the planet can give. So we're going to have to use a lot of the tools in your book to bring it down to where we can have that many people on the earth. So let's say I agree, and I do agree, that you've got a great collection of tools in this book. The challenge always is, how can we communicate with the billions of people who need it? They're not on the internet. They probably can't read, almost definitely can't afford to buy a book. What are your ideas to propagate what you've found?
That's a great question, because you don't want to just preach to the NGOs. You want to reach the people that need these things. There are a number of outlets. Schools are, of course, our biggest hope. And the advances in education, even though the children don't have computers maybe at home, more and more schools are going to be having them. So, and radio is one of the most effective ways, since we're on the radio. Let's give a shout-out to radio. In places that are still very low-tech, radio is often accessible. People have, communities have radios, and they have radio broadcasting, which is hyper-local. So they can run educational edutainment to explain concepts to people that they might not have otherwise had access to. A really effective way of reaching women is through women's self-help groups and women's cooperatives. They generally are a band of women that are working together. Usually they're farmers or women that have gotten microloans from a microfinance institution. And there's an educational and leadership component to those. So women are exposed to new ideas. They get a chance to develop more self-confidence and become leaders and together, women individually, women are very disempowered. But as a group, there's more chance of their being able to really speak up and speak out. One thing that's great about the internet for those that have access is that it's two-way. So it isn't just us telling people what they should do. It's women can be speaking to one another about what they want and what they need. And we can be a little bit more attentive. We have access now to data that no one would have ever had before because of cell phones. So I would expect that the internet in the end is probably going to be the way that people, the demand for it is huge, and a lot of these ideas will come along with it.
So you cover some other topics in the book, such as finance and also some legal things. Just tell us about a couple of the ideas from that section of your book.
I'd love to. I am very much, as I said, in love with the technical, the handheld tools. They're so clever. But I realize that what hampers women is not just the absence of tools. It's patriarchy and legal systems that actively discriminate against women. So I do have a section of human rights. Human rights are women's rights and human rights are the same. So registering the birth of children is very important. Working against violence against women is very important. One of my favorite mashups is a number of women in Egypt started an app called Harass Map, and they use basic mapping skills that you can use, global positioning, that sort of thing. And they designed a map where women can add information where they were harassed in the neighborhood. Often it's when they go to the public latrine, for example. So once women have access to this kind of technology, then they can use it in ways that are useful to them, and they can share with local police. This is a hot spot. This is where a lot of women are getting harassed, and actually they can do something about it. So it's very important that we focus on ways in which women are more legally empowered. And I included a lot of financial tools because I mentioned before that many of these tools pay for themselves because they save money, especially if they're solar. You no longer need to be paying for fuel if you have a solar panel that's charging from the sun. But people need the entry-level buy-in. They don't have enough money to buy a solar panel, but they can buy it on the installment plan. So you need a financial tool to get people over the hurdle so that they can obtain these beneficial tools. So microfinance and insurance, mobile money is huge. In Kenya, for example, most everybody now sends their money electronically. And that's great for poor people because they never had bank accounts. They didn't have access to checking. If they had a cash economy, and cash, women carrying cash is a bad combination. They're extremely vulnerable. This way, they're much more secure and they don't have to travel places, which is also great from the standpoint of transportation. The fewer people that have to move around, the less gasoline you're going to be using.
Wow, this is like a travel tour. You're telling me things that I have just entirely missed. Is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners as we wrap up here, Betsy?
Well, I would just like to tell them that in my book, I knew that people would want to be engaged, not just giving money, but in other helpful ways. So for each entry, I included an item that the reader might want to further involve themselves in. So I tried to make it as easy as possible for people to become activists on their own or supporters of causes. It's important. Being an advocate is extremely important. And with the simple tools of the internet, you can really help get messages out about what's important.
Is there a website, a Facebook page, or Twitter tag where people can follow you and this book?
I am at 100under100.org, and I have a ton of resources on my website. So any kid that needs to write a paper, it's all there for you. My Twitter is at Betsy Twitch. That's my name. And the Facebook page is facebook.com/100under100. So if you like my Facebook page, I keep updating every time I learn something new about one of the tools in the book. They just won an award or they have a new version out. I post that. So you can learn more about what's happening in real time with these tools. I keep updating.
Our guest, Betsy Teutsch, has lots of ideas and affordable strategies to start making the lives of global women better. The book is $100 under $100, 100 Ideas for Empowering Global Women. You can find links to Betsy on her Facebook page and following her on Twitter, and I'll put links to all that in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Betsy, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
It's been a pleasure, and I think people really need to know that we can get people out of poverty and shrink carbon.
Good news. I'm Alex Smith, reporting. From Ithaca, New York, and more lately Venice Beach, California, here is Finian Makepeace singing 2060.
A couple of years ago, I had a dream that really changed the way that I look at the future. I was in a refugee camp as an old man. Climate change had really taken its toll. My granddaughter snuck me under the fence and took me to a city that lay in ruin. And she turned up to me and asked, with tears in her eyes, why I hadn't done something to stop this from happening. And really changed how I look at what we need to do and what we can do, how we can make a big shift and a big difference. So I wrote this song. It's called 2060. Dark of night, when the fears take flight, I fell into a dream. I'm still haunted and cold, and it shakes my soul to say what I've seen. It was the summer 2060. I was an old man, one of 12 billion men, women, and children. In a sea of sand, in a sea of growing sand. A frail young child, my own granddaughter, led me from the throng. We marched through doorways of endless sorrows. And she sang this sad, sad song. It's too late to hope when the world begins to bleed. It's too late for love when our hearts are filled with grief. She cried, oh, Grandpa, on the way to this hell, how did you justify these wrongs were right, or these actions might not be what bring us down. It was in your power to shift it all. Well, I lay frozen in shame till the morning came, when I felt my lover's kiss. And to my surprise, as I opened my eyes, she described a dream of bliss. It was this summer 2060. We stood hand in hand. The planet flourished, each soul was nourished with peace throughout the land. With peace throughout the land. Ooh. Ooh. And all the children born free and fearless share the same desire. All for each other, sisters and brothers, they sing in a universal choir. It's too late to bleed when hope has freed the doves. It's too late for grief when our hearts are filled with love. And it's in our power it's in our power to make it so.
I think we have Rick Sterling. Well, hello, Rick Sterling. Are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you today?
Very good. And I'm glad to be talking to you. We've had a few technical problems, but now you have two articles that have caught everyone's attention. And today's, and I want to link it to, one is about these NGOs, that particularly the group called the White Helmets, and the other is your article on how Russia Russian athletes were unfairly banned at the Olympics. Let's begin with the White Helmets, because I read in the Toronto Star that they have been nominated for the – and I'll read you the way they write it. White Helmets, uh-huh. White Helmets get Nobel Prize nod for dangerous war zone work.
Wow.
A Toronto Star reader is if you're forgiven for thinking they'd already won it. You're one who's spoken out against their being nominated, or not nominated, but for even being considered. What is it about the White Helmets?
Well, basically, the White Helmets is a propaganda tool of the West. I wrote about it in an article that was published in Dissident Voice. The article was called Seven Steps of Highly Effective Manipulators. And the subtitle was White Helmets, Avaz, Nicholas Kristof, and Syria No-Fly Zone. The No-Fly Zone just doesn't go away, and in fact, it's becoming a more and more more of a dangerous possibility. But the White Helmets, as I researched into it, the chain of events was that some big government, or possibly Saudi Arabia or Qatar or the U.S. probably. Gave a contract to a company called Purpose Incorporated. And the contract was for them to create movement around Syria. In other words, a big campaign to promote public support for the regime change policy that the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Israel, and a host of other countries, including Canada, has been pushing for. Mm-hmm. And so what Purpose did, and in my article, there's reference links to it. I got a lot of the information from their own websites, in fact. Their wording was they incubated the Syria campaign.
Incubated, lovely.
Yes, that was their word. They incubated the Syria campaign, and you can look online and see all sorts of information about the Syria campaign. And the Syria campaign was the organization that branded the White Helmets. Mm-hmm. It was actually another name for it is the Syria Civil Defense, and that was basically a British military contractor received a contract to do some training in rescue operations in Turkey. So they basically brought some Syrians out. They trained them in some rescue operations led by this guy James Le Mesurier, the British contractor. And then that is basically what became the White Helmets.
Yeah.
They got more and more money. They got, I think it was $18 million last year from the U.S. They got a total of $35 million. They've been funded by the U.S. and the U.K. right from the start. And what they do is it's a very devious kind of role that they play. They tug at people's heartstrings. Here are these brave people who are risking their lives doing this and that rescue work. And what their primary role is to push for greater U.S. intervention. So they actively call for the U.S. to intervene in Syria, basically a no-fly zone is what they call for. Well, a no-fly zone basically involves attacking. It involves war on another country because you have to start by knocking out the air defense installations of the country to eliminate the possibility of them flying in the region. Mm-hmm. So it's a slick propaganda tool. It actually undercuts the work of the Red Crescent, which honestly does work in both sides. They are genuinely neutral, and they work both in the opposition-held areas as well as the government-held areas.
Yeah, by the way,
doing
I hear,
ambulance
yeah.
work.
There's
the
an
White Helmets not. They only work in the areas, and it's primarily they work in the areas controlled by Nusra, that is the Al-Qaeda, the Al-Qaeda brand in Syria.
Yeah. By the way, I hear there's an issue there. It sounds like the old Medicine Sans Frontières, who managed to insinuate themselves between the Red Cross and the work it did, so that people began to treat medicine. Medicine Sans Frontières ended up winning a Nobel, so I suppose we might not be surprised if these guys win it.
Well, I think we will. One of my compañeras, Vanessa Beely, launched a petition. The last time I checked, our petition had as many signatures as theirs did, and our petition was to not give the not give the Nobel Prize to the White Helmets, and we basically exposed what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So they do. They just they only work on one side of the conflict, and they basically serve as a kind of a PR campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I the first time I heard about them, and the reason I researched into them was that somebody I know and respect thought they were pretty good, and he was telling me about them. This was maybe a year and a half or 2 years ago. So I started looking into them, and that's when I discovered they were actually a creation of this marketing company.
And talk about marketing, by the way, White Helmet. What could be more pure?
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, thank you very much for that. And I think I'm going to write to the Toronto Star and tell them to get your article. The other thing is we need to ask you about is this how politics is creeping into – well, it's creeping into the Olympics. Russian athletes were – unfairly banned, and by according to your article. Now, why do you say that they were unfairly banned?
Because most of the athletes who were prevented from competing at the Olympics are clean athletes. There are many that have been tested dozens and hundreds of times and never been found to be doping or to be using performance enhancing drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So now this is a fascinating story. And it's going to be in the air over the next 24 hours. So your interview, your call today is very, very timely because either tonight or tomorrow, the Appeal Commission of the Paralympics is going to either reverse or sustain the banning of the Russian Paralympic athletes, 267 disabled people, physically or mentally disabled, who were training to compete in the Paralympics, which starts in early September.
Yeah, some of them have already
in,
run.
In Rio,
mm-hmm.
They were banned by the International Paralympic Committee following the recommendations of Canadian lawyer Richard McLaren.
Okay, we're ashamed.
This guy McLaren produced a report known as the McLaren Report that is really a. It's kind of amazing that it has not been scrutinized and criticized more than it has, because he makes all sorts of accusations and he doesn't provide the evidence.
Well, you point out that he didn't actually give the Russian athletic organizations an opportunity to reply or rebut information.
Exactly. He admits it, and not only that, the Russians, a Russian Ministry of Sports official. Sent what he calls a lengthy narrative with attachments. They sent some information and facts, and he refused to consider it. So, I mean, it's very elementary justice that you, when you're going to accuse somebody of something, you give them a chance to respond and defend themselves or rebut false information. In this case, McLaren didn't take the trouble to go to Russia and talk with people. He didn't try to communicate with them from wherever he lives in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And he rejected their own submissions. It's astounding. And this is the guy. Mm-hmm. They're based, this is part of the, connected with the World Anti-Doping Agency, based in Montreal. He spoke privately to the International Paralympic Committee and the IAAF.
Privately?
Exactly.
Where's the
track and field. There are about 30 different sports that make up the Olympics, and one of them, the biggest, is track and field. But you've got all these other sports, whether it's handball or volleyball or basketball or, you've got and swimming and so forth. But the track and field is the biggest. Well, McLaren spoke privately with the leaders of the IAAF, and that resulted in the banning of the entire Russian track and field team. Yeah. So the problem here is doping is a real problem, and there is a history of doping problems in Russia. We all remember Ben Johnson. I mean, this is not a uniquely Russian problem.
And Marion Jones, thank you very
Marion
much.
Marion Jones. I mean,
we could trade
US,
these names.
A lot of athletes have.
Well, listen. Two American athletes participated in the 4x4. Two of them had previously been banned for using drugs.
Exactly. So,
and everybody's happy with that.
The problem was that McLaren produced a report that made a lot of accusations, state-sponsored doping. Now, he never said that all of the Russians were doping.
Mm-hmm. Hello? Hello? I think we lost Rick. Sound like an interesting part there. I wonder if we've lost me. I don't think so. We will double check on Rick. Because I can tell you, I recommend this article, by the way. And he, as he said, here's the way to do it. Just write Rick Sterling and the word Olympics, and you will find not one but several. Somebody around here likes Johnny Cash. I think we are joined by Ellen Hansen. Are you there, Ellen? Hello?
I'm here.
You are very patient, Ellen, and we are very grateful. It's been called the Freedom Flotilla over the years, and there have been many the exercise, this attempt to reach Gaza. And this year is called Women's Boat to Gaza. Well, what is the mission overall of this project?
We are a group of women from all over the world. We want to sail in solidarity with the Palestinian women. So we're going to sail on a boat with only a female crew and participants with this solidarity message.
Mm-hmm. And this is remarkable. Is it true there's going to be a women crew and captains, is that right?
Yes, there's only going to be women filling all the roles on the boats, yes.
And that is an interesting challenge. Now, when are you going to the dates, roughly? When would you be sailing?
We're going to leave Barcelona on the 14th of September. So in about 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And your goal is to reach the Gaza approximately October the 1st?
Yes. Early October is our goal. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's correct. And we're planning to stop at a few European ports on the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we're just in the middle of all the preparations now, and as you can guess, there's a lot of things to do and finalize and organize before the sail off.
Uh-huh. We were speaking in the moments we were having difficulty reaching you, underlining the fact that today there was an Israeli Air Force struck at Gaza. How does that impact for all of you? I mean, this is another obstacle, I presume, is this the fact that there's always a threat of war in that region?
Yes, we are very Well, it's horrible news for all of us, and it also proves the fact that we need to do this. It's really necessary for us to do this to shed light on what's actually going on and what is happening in Gaza. I mean, in a lot of countries, this wasn't even brought up on the news. So, you know, it's really important for us to show the world and to recognize that these things are going on. So, I mean, I can only speak for myself, but it makes it more important for me to follow through this mission and actually successfully reach Gaza.
I know that the former Nobel Prize winner, Margaret, I forget her second name, but she has been, she and others have been on these voyages in the past. There are some prominent women who are going to be joining you. Is that right? Could you tell us who they are? Some of them?
Yes, absolutely. Let me just refresh their names. Just give me a moment. Well, yes, Merritt McGuire is one of them.
I'm sorry, that's who it is, Merritt McGuire, yes.
Yes, and then we also have Naomi Wallace, as you know. We have Dr. Fasiha Hassan from Malaysia. She's a doctor and a humanitarian worker involved in a lot of different projects around the world. We also have Gjerd von der Lippe from Norway. She's a former athlete and now she's a professor. Adding to that, we have Topçuoglu. I'm not sure how you pronounce her surname, but she's the wife of the one of the people that was killed on Mavi Marmara, and she's also an athlete and a coach. And we're about to announce further names in the next weeks, and there will be a lot of things happening going forward. So those are a few of the names.
Yeah. So when part of your voyage then is to visit ports and to have public meetings, and some of these individuals, I assume, be available to press and also to give speeches. How many ships are going? Do you have an approximate number?
At the moment, we have announced one ship. So that is what we are.
I had read that there was a ship called the Zatuni. I was hoping that would be one of them. We have a place here in the city, Bet Zatun. Everyone loves it. Public meetings are held there. And we recently had a member of the Knesset from Israel, a Palestinian, who gave a talk Thursday night. He was very, very appreciative of the efforts of women's boat to Gaza. And what kind of attention are you getting? For example, I think you're in Sweden. Is the Swedish media following this?
Actually, we have had a more positive impact than at the start of Ship to Gaza Sweden. It's been difficult the past years to get through to media and to the general people, but this project has really, really given us attention and a lot of support and positive feedback, which is really, really amazing. I'm having interviews are invited to speak at different events about this project, and it's really, really positive. We had this bus tour during the summer, which was touring and visiting, I think, about 20 different, I wouldn't call it cities, but cities and villages spreading information about Gaza and the women spoke to Gaza, and it's been really, really breaking through. And I think that's my personal analyze of this feedback. But I think that the issue of women's rights is really a new angle. And I mean, all women can relate to being a woman and what that means. And so it reaches a whole new group of supporters, which is really great.
Mm-hmm. And we're speaking to Ellen Hansen, and she is with the Women's Boat to Gaza. That's part of the historic effort called the Freedom Flotilla. Gaza is under a blockade. Well, can you just, in the last moment, say, tell us, what is this blockade doing? What is the life of the Gazans as a result of this blockade?
Well, really, it's affecting all parts of society and all natural elements of all of our lives, basic elements, education, work. 97% of the water is undrinkable, and the reconstruction from the last war is not really happening because there are no resources for that. And I mean, the fact that people can't move in and out of the country, they can't export and import.
Yeah, it's as hard for them to come out as for you to go in, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
They cannot go.
I have a friend that is there right now, and he's just waiting to try and get out. So, you know, it's living. I mean, the easiest way of explaining it is that they're living in the world's biggest outdoor prison. And by 2020, the UN is expecting it to be uninhabitable. So it just gets worse and worse. And as we can see what happened today, you know, it's something needs to change drastically. And that's what we're trying to do.
Well, Ellen Hansen, we're very grateful you gave us the time. I'm sorry we had difficulty reaching you, but it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was my pleasure, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. That's Ellen Hansen of the Women's Boat to Gaza. And all you have to do is write Women's Boat to Gaza, and you will be able to be in touch and help in any way that you can.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael Beer, director of the group Nonviolence International, who assesses the escalation of violence in Syria after the Turkish military crossed the northern Syrian border and attacked U.S.-backed Kurdish rebels. Chip Burleigh, an author and researcher on racism and intolerance, who discusses recent media focus on the so-called alt-right activists leading the Trump presidential campaign and their racist belief system. And Chad Cordell of the Kanawha Forest Coalition, who talks about how the activist campaign he led succeeded in pressuring the state of West Virginia to shut down a mountaintop removal coal mine near a state forest. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
During a visit by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, Nigeria's military announced that Boko Haram's vicious leader, Abubakar Shekau, had been killed in an airstrike in northeast Nigeria. This is not the first time that Shekau was reported killed by the Nigerian government, but comes at a critical time for President Buhari. For months, the Nigerian regime has requested that the Obama administration provide more military aid, including the sale of a dozen A-29 Super Tucano attack aircraft. Boko Haram, a brutal Islamist movement in West Africa, is now an affiliate of ISIS. The terrorist group came to the world's attention in 2014 after they kidnapped 280 schoolgirls in the village of Chibok. Over 200 of the girls are still missing. Over the last decade, 20,000 people have died in clashes with Boko Haram fighters. Today, Bama, the largest city that Boko Haram had held near the Cameroon border, is in shambles. The Nigerian army took control in March as thousands of people fled and widespread hunger and malnutrition set in. Even before the Nigerian airstrike targeting Abubakar Shekau, his status as Boko Haram's leader was in doubt. A new leader, Abu Masab al-Barnawi, the son of the founder of Boko Haram, emerged to challenge Shekau's position, declaring that attacks on mosques must stop, an initiative supported by ISIS's Salafist leadership. According to Foreign Policy magazine, indigenous women in Canada are four times more likely to be murdered than white women. Official statistics reveal that over 1,200 Native women were killed or have gone missing since the 1980s. This disturbing information comes at a time when Canada is dealing with its long legacy of racism against Native peoples. A shameful chapter in the nation's history includes the forced relocation of over 150,000 Native children who were sent to so-called resident schools where they were compelled to assimilate into white culture. The hostile attitudes toward Native peoples run deep in Canadian law enforcement, who have often blamed cases of missing or slain Indigenous women on drug overdoses, suicide, or runaways. In 2013, an academic paper identified 824 cases of slain or missing Indigenous women. The research prompted an official investigation by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who investigated nearly 1,200 cases of violence against Native women between 1980 and 2012. Cameron Alexis of the Assembly of First Nations called the findings a national shame and a national tragedy. When Canadians overwhelmingly elected Justin Trudeau as Prime Minister last October, one of his first acts was to announce a national inquiry into Indigenous murders. The victims deserve justice, he told a gathering of First Nation chiefs in Gatineau, Quebec. Their families deserve an opportunity to heal and to be heard. Young Chicago activists known as Future Fighters are visible at rallies organized by the Fight for 15 movement and Black Lives Matter. Future Fighters was launched by young members of the Service Employees International Union in Illinois and Indiana. These union activists are committed to exposing and combating income inequality, police brutality, and homelessness. Future Fighters founder Lakeisha Collins, a nursing home worker, approached an SEIU official seeking support for a new group of union members under age 35. After Michael Brown and Trayvon Martin were murdered, Collins told the publication Labor Notes, "We wanted to do more than protest in the streets, so we came up with Know Your Rights trainings." The first training attracted 70 union members, and workshops were held every few months on topics such as rights of protesters, race and class stereotyping, and the role of labor in the U.S. civil rights movement. Chandra Robinson, a co-founder of Future Fighters, recalled that discussions focused on how to de-escalate dangerous situations with law enforcement and on the long history of the judicial system working against the interests of minority groups. The movement later broadened to involve activists affiliated with Black Lives Matter in confronting police brutality. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
After a series of terrorist bomb attacks targeting police and civilians inside Turkey,
and a failed coup attempt against his government, Turkey's president, Tayyip Erdogan, ordered his nation's military to invade northern Syria with the stated goal of guaranteeing his citizens' security at home and in neighboring countries. The offensive, which began on August 24th, saw Turkish tanks, artillery, and Syrian rebel allies, backed by air power, quickly capture the Syrian border town of Jarablus from Islamic State militants. But since that initial assault, Turkish forces have moved into areas controlled by fighters allied with the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, a coalition that includes the Kurdish YPG militia that has won praise from the Obama administration for its effectiveness in battling ISIS. Clashes between Turkish-backed forces and the YPG have killed at least 25 Kurdish fighters, amid accusations that Turkey has targeted Kurdish civilians in airstrikes, a charge that Ankara denies. Washington has criticized Turkey's attack on the Kurds and is working to stop the fighting between its two allies. While Turkey favors the overthrow of the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad and opposes ISIS, President Erdogan's priority is widely believed to be preventing the establishment of a Kurdish enclave either in Syria or inside Turkey. Your reporter spoke with Michael Beer, director of the group Nonviolence International, who talks about the escalation of violence in Syria after the Turkish invasion and prospects for success in U.S.-Russian ceasefire talks taking place in Geneva.
The Turkish president, Erdogan, has been quite clear about his goals, if we can believe him, which I think we can. And his stated goals are that he wants to go after the ISIL, or sometimes called ISIS or Daesh group, which is the Islamic State. And he also wants to prevent the Kurds from capturing the entire Turkish-Syrian border area. And these are his two stated goals. He may have others that we don't know. But he's been attacking both ISIL groups as well as Kurdish Syria Defense Force groups. And this is an escalation of the war. Turkey, of course, has been deeply involved in providing all kinds of weaponry and political support to various actors fighting against Assad, and has shelled the border areas for a variety of reasons, usually shelling the Kurds. And this is an escalation where they've actually sent in tanks, and we don't know how long they're going to be there. President Erdogan has said in the last few days that he is there until ISIL and the Kurds are destroyed. Well, I mean, he's going to be there 1,000 years if he thinks he's going to be destroying the Kurds. So we're just not sure where this is going, other than to say that Syria now has been intervened by many, many foreign actors. And, of course, the wars, there's more than one, are going to get worse as long as we have lots of outside actors who are pouring fuel on the fire.
Michael, also in the news recently has been the Russian bombing campaign in alliance with the Assad government to try to end the stalemate in one of Syria's largest cities, Aleppo, with tragic consequences. Just thousands of civilians have been killed, and that's a huge city with a civilian population. Now, shortage of food and medicine, hospitals have been bombed. Russia had been using, I guess, for a short while, air bases in Iran, and then were kicked out. Lots to talk about there, but maybe we could focus on the human tragedy that has been unfolding for a long time now in Aleppo.
I thank you for focusing attention with your question about the human suffering in Syria. It's easy to get lost in this very complicated political war game of various factions and who the various external actors are, and lose sight of the fact that Syria is being ripped apart, and that people are being and civilians are being killed on an enormous scale and are suffering so much. We are seeing in Aleppo an attempt by the Russians and the Assad regime and the Iranians to try to militarily win back, as they say, Aleppo. And the suffering is tremendous. They're bombing hospitals. They're bombing schools. They're starving out areas, both sides, all sides are trying to starve out areas of the other. As long as we have a lot of external actors or even internal actors that think that they can win this conflict militarily, this is unfortunately going to continue. We desperately need to have peace talks to end this fighting because there really is no military solution or victory. It may be that the Russians and the Assad regime think that they can get Aleppo back by bombing it to smithereens, and the suffering is just unbelievable. But even if they get Aleppo back, much of the country, big chunks of the country, are not under the control of the Assad regime and are not likely to be. And there's just desperately needs to be talking. And unfortunately, the U.S. is the lead country, the leading country in the world in terms of military power, economic power, political power. We're not really in the place to be leading talks because, frankly, we won't talk to everybody. The United States will not talk to some of the major external actors like Hezbollah. We won't talk to ISIL. We need to talk to everybody because there is no military solution. In order for this to come to conclusion, we have to get all the stakeholders at the table. Unfortunately, the U.S. is taking sides, and so we're not in the place where we can be a peacemaker, and we're helping pour a lot of fuel on this fire, unfortunately.
What are the prospects, if any, that there could be a breakthrough between Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov in talks in Geneva to arrive at some formula for a ceasefire so the killing will stop?
Well, there have been some suggestions this week that they're just not able to reach an agreement. And we're going to need sustained pressure from citizens around the world. Unfortunately, there's not much of a movement in the United States yet around this, but I think, and I'm hoping it's growing, to pressure the United States to move towards a ceasefire and a political solution in a more serious way. At the moment, I'm pessimistic that there don't seem to be on the horizon the kind of pressures that we need to get to pressure the United States and Russia to try to help make a deal as two of the leading players here.
That was Michael Beer, director of the group Nonviolence International. Learn more about the many nations supporting proxy forces engaged in Syria's civil war and prospects for peace by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The 2016 presidential election campaign, already marked by Donald Trump's blatant appeals to bigotry and finding scapegoats to blame for the nation's weak economy, sunk to a new low recently with the appointment of Steve Bannon as Trump's new campaign CEO. Bannon's rise to a top spot in mainstream U.S. politics provoked many questions, because as executive chairman of Breitbart Media, a popular right-wing website, he had cultivated a sanctuary for white supremacist, misogynist, and anti-Semitic expression. After Trump's leadership change, the media highlighted the ties between Bannon, Breitbart, and a loose network of ultra-conservative, mostly online activists, known as the alt-right or alternative right. Although those associated with the alt-right movement have no officially recognized ideology, commonly held views include opposition to multiculturalism, immigration, and feminism, as well as an affinity for white nationalism, white supremacy, anti-Semitism, and nativism. Democratic Party presidential nominee Hillary Clinton responded to Bannon's leadership in the Trump campaign with a speech in Reno, Nevada, devoted to denouncing Trump's divisive rhetoric, appealing to the emerging racist ideology known as the alt-right, and warned that a nationalist conservative fringe had taken over the Republican Party. Your reporter spoke with Chip Berlay, an investigative journalist, research analyst, scholar, and activist, who has written about racism and intolerance for over four decades. Here he examines the belief system of the alt-right and the significance of their presence in the upper echelon of the Republican Party in mainstream U.S. politics.
There's a lot of baloney that's pretty smelly coming out of this crowd, and whether or not they really want to adopt the pseudoscientific racist and anti-Semitic theories of Hitler's Nazi Germany, is a debatable point. Some do, some don't. It's a very diffuse network. There are people who think that an ethno-nationalist state has to share a particular religion or lack of religion. There are people who view themselves as libertarian or right-wing anarchists, while others call themselves true conservatives, the real conservatives, going back to, you know, a period of writing about conservatism in Germany in the 20s and 30s. So it's very complicated, but it is oddly quite intellectual among the ideologues. But a lot of the men who adopt it, and it's mostly men, are really aggressive thugs and jerks. And they're not just anti-feminist, they're misogynist, they're not just anti-gay, but they're horrifically homophobic. And so, you know, it's not the research I enjoy doing.
Chip, tell us about Stephen Bannon, the executive chairman of Breitbart Media, who's now moved over to be the CEO of the Trump campaign. What is his connection, directly or indirectly, with this alt-right movement?
Well, he basically beats the drum for them. He, I think, is a political operative that is quite loathsome. One of the things that I think is really horrifying is that he basically comes out of a kind of working class background and got involved in, you know, working in these circles and made a documentary about, you know, Ronald Reagan facing down evil. And Breitbart News, of course, he became, you know, the chair of the Breitbart News company, the parent company, and Breitbart himself was a vicious rumor monger and personality attacker, basically became a very influential political news media person, but yet he identifies as a conservative. He defined himself as essentially anti-establishment and talks about the, you know, global political elites who run everything. So it's kind of hard to pin some of these folks down, but for Trump to make anyone connected with Breitbart, especially someone who is so high up in the organization — Breitbart, of course, is now dead, but there's still a Breitbart News kind of circulation stuff going on. So it's horrible that this is now considered part of the political discussion for a leading candidate in America for the presidency.
If you were to distinguish the differences between the alt-right movement and more explicitly racist groups like the KKK and neo-Nazis, what, if any, is that difference?
No, they wear better suits and they know which fork to use at the dinner table.
All right. I think that puts it squarely in plain language. Yeah, we got it. Thank you, Chip.
What can I say? It's the same basic ideology. It's just whether or not it's presented on a platter or in a paper, you know, dish.
Chip, what in your mind is the significance of the presence of some adherence to this alt-right philosophy at the highest levels of the Trump for President campaign? What does it mean for the Republicans, and what does it mean for mainstream U.S. politics?
The United States political system has already been pushed very far to the right, historically, from the time of the Taft and the anti-union, anti-big government move, all the way before the election of Roosevelt. So we're already pushed way to the right. Now we have introduced into the political system a theory which led to the murder of millions in Europe. So, you know, we should take that seriously. We're being pushed now to accept as a legitimate, or at least active and effective, political ideology basically an idea that we're going to have to get rid of a huge sector of our population physically by expulsion. And arguably, if some have said openly in the alt-right network that if the people don't leave, they'll be forced to leave or they'll be killed.
That was Chip Berlay, an investigative journalist, research analyst, scholar, and activist who has written about racism and intolerance for over four decades. Learn more about the links between the alt-right movement, racism, and the Trump campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection hardly ever turns down a permit application for companies seeking to conduct mountaintop removal coal mining. That's the extraction process in which a company literally blows the top off of a mountain ridge to mine the coal seams beneath. Debris is often dumped into the valleys below, which thus far has smothered more than 1,500 miles of streams. But West Virginia's DEP recently signed an unprecedented consent decree with Keystone Development, a subsidiary of the Florida-based Keystone Industries, to permanently stop mountaintop removal mining at the KD No. 2 strip mine located on the outskirts of Charleston, West Virginia's capital. The site is adjacent to a state forest, popular with residents for hiking and other recreational activities. The mine was initially approved by the DEP in May 2014 for strip mining and the explosive blasting within 600 feet of the Kanawha State Forest and within 1,500 feet of homes in the nearby Holler. The Kanawha Forest Coalition was formed by local residents early in 2014 to protect their community from the impacts of the 413-acre KD No. 2 mine. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus recently visited West Virginia and attended the coalition's victory rally on August 23rd. Here, coalition coordinator Chad Cordell traces the history of the successful campaign to close down the mine.
In the first year after the permit was issued, approximately 100 acres out of the total 413-acre permit area was stripped of trees and partially mined. Mining has been temporarily suspended since about early 2015. So at this point, three-fourths of the permit area has not been disturbed, has not been mined. And we are here today after over 2 years of work by the Kanawha Forest Coalition to announce that the DEP has finally ordered a permanent stop to the mining at the KD No. 2 mine. This is a powerful demonstration of the impact that citizens can have when we take a stand, we stay persistent, and we don't back down. Many people thought that this mine was unstoppable after the permit was issued, but we doubled down. We gathered over 5,000 signatures on a petition to demand that the permit be revoked. We held community meetings throughout Charleston and in Loudoundale, attended by hundreds of people. We held rallies here at the Capitol and at the DEP. We monitored the water quality coming from the mine site on a weekly basis. We met consistently with the DEP and even met once with Keystone Industries owner Tom Scholl, who lives in Florida and who, after refusing to meet with us for months, we happened to spot at a downtown Charleston restaurant when he was in town, and we sat down with him for an impromptu meeting. During that meeting, we asked Tom Scholl about the pollution coming off his mines, and he told us that the DEP would fix the water. In other words, Tom Scholl expects the citizens of West Virginia to clean up his mess. Unfortunately, the legal framework that allows for strip mining to persist is built on a mountain of false assumptions. And to look at the actual conditions on the ground, like we have, and not just the assumptions that are made on paper when these applications are put in, means having to accept that strip mining and mountaintop removal simply cannot be done without irreparable harm to our land, our water, and our health. It's up to us as a community to continue tearing down the coal industry's mountain of lies just as effectively as they've torn down the mountains of our homeland. With this order, the DEP has taken a step toward addressing the many issues at the KD No. 2 mine. But these aren't isolated issues. These are widespread problems, and they are inherent in the process of strip mining. This campaign was never about just stopping this one mine. It's about shining a bright light on the issue of strip mining and showing just how damaging it really is. Many other communities in West Virginia are being harmed by surface mining and mountaintop removal. The DEP website currently lists over 20 pending surface mine applications in West Virginia, including the Long Ridge No. 2 and the Center Contour mines, which are being actively opposed right now by our friends at the Coal River Mountain Watch in Raleigh County, West Virginia. The Knauf Forest Coalition strongly urges the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection to deny these permits that will inevitably lead to the same sorts of issues we've seen on the Katy No. 2 mine. I'd like to wrap up with a quote from the late West Virginia organizer, Don West, who said the abuse of the land always goes hand in hand with the abuse of the people. Always. We've stopped the abuse of the land in this one little area next to Kanawha State Forest, but it's long past time that we stopped the abuse of our land and people across West Virginia.
That was Chad Cordell, coordinator of the Kanawha Forest Coalition. Learn more about the group and growing opposition to mountaintop removal coal mining by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Today's show with news that a federal judge has denied a request from former Black Panther and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal for a life-saving medication that could cure his hepatitis C. Mumia has been in prison in Pennsylvania since he was convicted of killing a police officer in 1981. He always maintained his innocence, and Amnesty International said he didn't receive a fair trial. His death sentence was overturned in 2011 on constitutional grounds, and he is now serving life without parole. Last year, Mumia sued to receive an antiviral treatment for hepatitis C after he was placed in critical condition. An official said he was not sick enough to be eligible. The medication has about a 95% cure rate, but it cost the state about $55,000 for a 12-week course of the drug.
On Wednesday, U.S. District Court Judge Robert Mariani denied a motion for preliminary injunction that would have let him order the treatment without going to trial. The denial was based on a technicality that the lawsuit should have named the state's Hepatitis C Committee for Prisoner Treatment instead of targeting the warden and the prison system's medical chief. Even as the judge denied Mumia Abu-Jamal's motion, he also found that Pennsylvania's Hepatitis C protocol for prisoners fails to meet constitutional standards and could prolong suffering. Pennsylvania treats just about 5 of more than 6,000 prisoners who are infected with hepatitis C. This mirrors untreated epidemics in prisons around the country. Well, PrisonRadio.org spoke to Mumia Abu-Jamal after the judge's ruling. This is what Mumia said.
It's a beginning, and it's a good beginning, that a federal judge recognizes that what the Commonwealth is doing and has been doing for years is not only unjust, but not right, unconstitutional, a violation of fundamental fairness and the human right to life. So it's a beginning, and it's a good beginning, and we want a good ending.
For more, we're joined by Bob Boyle, one of Mumia Abu-Jamal's attorneys in the case, and by Democracy Now! Correspondent Renee Feltz, who also writes for The Guardian, where she covered these developments. Bob, explain, because the judge clearly was angered by what's happening to the prisoners, but ruled on this technicality.
The judge ruled that the Pennsylvania protocol for treating hepatitis C is unconstitutional. Essentially, under their policy, a human being has to be on the verge of death. Your blood vessels have to be in danger of bursting inside your chest before you're given this life-saving medication. And the judge found that this is blatantly unconstitutional. He only ruled against us on the ground that we did not name this so-called hepatitis C committee, this secret group of people who meet in secret and decide whether someone gets this drug. We did sue the warden, the head of the Pennsylvania Health Department, and we did not even know of the existence of this committee at the time we filed the lawsuit. So it's a technicality that we are going to challenge and fight until Mumia gets this life-saving medication.
When 5,000 prisoners in Pennsylvania have hepatitis C, but only 5 are receiving treatment?
It's probably closer to 6,000. And I think their latest estimate, they've upped it all the way to 30 out of 6,000 who are receiving this treatment. And it's because this drug costs not just $55,000, $84,000. $1,000 per pill. So the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections is acting in an unconstitutional manner in this regard, but also it is unconscionable that drug companies, and it's only because we have the horrible health system that we have, can charge this amount of money, denial of which could cause death.
But hepatitis C, if left untreated, leads to cirrhosis of the liver, which costs even more to treat.
Absolutely, and causes death and irreversible damage. And also, remember, hepatitis C is a communicable disease. So people come out of prison by either sharing needles or sexual contact, can pass the virus to other people who then have hepatitis C and have to be treated. So it is an extremely short-sighted, and that's really a euphemism. It's really criminal what's going on.
Renee Feltz, put this in a national context.
Well, it's not just Pennsylvania that we're talking about. Almost every state across the country has thousands of inmates in their prisons who have hepatitis C. Many of them don't actually know that they have it because the prisons don't provide testing. There have been class action lawsuits not only in Pennsylvania, in addition to what Mumia and his attorneys have filed, but there's also class action lawsuits in Tennessee, where there's another limited number of prisoners who are able to get the treatment, also in Massachusetts and also in Minnesota. Now, New York here has done a little bit better. They've increased their funding in the recent years by about 350% to provide these life-saving hepatitis C drugs to prisoners, including, interestingly, to Robert Seth Hayes, who is a former Black Panther and considered a political prisoner. He was able to be cured of hep C when he got this treatment here in New York, but he has still many, many other problems with his health. He's elderly, and he's still pushing to be granted parole. He's been denied 10 times.
Well, Renee, what about this issue of the drug companies? Because obviously for prisons at this cost, and with so many inmates suffering from hepatitis C, this is a budget buster for a lot of prison systems.
That's right. Now, the company Gilead makes this drug, and it was investigated by the Senate in 2014. And what they found by looking at the company's own documents is that the cost was not determined by development or the cost of acquiring the drug. It was simply to make money. And they weren't concerned about the access that it would, the challenges it would present to access.
And I would add in Egypt, for example, which isn't subject to U.S. patent laws, it costs about $100 a pill. $10 in India. So it's only in this country where it costs so much.
Well, we're going to leave it there, but of course, we'll continue to follow the story. Bob Boyle, attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal, and Renee Feltz, Democracy Now! Correspondent. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today's show is very special. In fact, the whole show today is going to be a conversation I had a little while ago with Andres Resendez. And it's a conversation that's all about the enslavement, the brutal and at times genocidal exploitation of Native peoples, Indians, in North and South America. Andres Resendez has written a book called The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. And Andres is also a professor of history at the University of California at Davis, right? And it's an outstanding book. And it's a book that many people have commented on, and that I tend to agree with this comment, that it's a book that has actually changed our understanding of history, and especially the history of North and South America, and what was done to the Native peoples. You know, when I think about what he says in the book and in this interview, I'm reminded of a powerful quotation from Karl Marx. "The discovery of gold and silver in America, the extirpation, enslavement, and entombment in mines of the Aboriginal population, the beginning of the conquest and looting of the East Indies, the turning of Africa into a warren for the commercial hunting of black skins, signalized the rosy dawn of the era of capitalist production." That can't be emphasized too much. I want people to really think about that as you're listening to this interview. Now, this is an essential part of the history of the development of capitalism, and it's a history that has been unknown or relegated to a few scattered scholarly papers that were accessible to only a few people. So now we're going to bring you Andres Resendez talking about his book that broke open all of that, that ended the situation that only a few people can know about this. So let's jump right into the interview I did with Andres Resendez. A little while ago, I came across a book that I was just drawn to immediately. The book is The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America, and it's by a man named Andres Resendez. And it's a landmark history, the sweeping story of the enslavement of tens of thousands of Indians across America from the time of the conquistadors up to the early 20th century. Since the time of Columbus, Indian slavery was illegal in much of the American continent. Yet, as Andres Resendez illuminates in his myth-shattering book, The Other Slavery, it was practiced for centuries as an open secret. There was no abolitionist movement to protect the tens of thousands of natives who were kidnapped and enslaved by the conquistadors, then forced to descend into the mouth of hell of 18th century silver mines, or later made to serve as domestics for Mormon settlers and rich Anglos. Resendez builds the incisive case that it was mass slavery more than epidemics that decimated Indian populations across North America. New evidence, including testimonies of courageous priests, rapacious merchants, Indian captives, and Anglo colonists, sheds light, too, on Indian enslavement of other Indians, as what started as a European business passed into the hands of indigenous operators and spread like wildfire across the vast tracts of the American Southwest. The Other Slavery reveals nothing less than a key missing piece of American history. For over two centuries, we have fought over, abolished, and tried to come to grips with African-American slavery. It is time for the West to confront an entirely separate, equally devastating enslavement that we have long failed truly to see. All right, and having said all that, I'm here talking today with the author of The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America, Andres Resendez. And Andres is a professor of history at the University of California, Davis. Andres, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
Sure. I'm going to, you know, do away with all little sort of back and forth because there's so much I have to ask you, man. I've read your book and I was just glued to it for days and days. It's really an amazing piece. So thank you very much for the piece just to start, man. It was like really something that people have to read. Now, when you talk about it, you entitled it The Other Slavery. Explain to people exactly what you're talking about there.
Right. Well, I use the term The Other Slavery in two different ways. One is, of course, that it's a system of bondage that targeted Native Americans as opposed to African Americans. But also, it is another slavery in the sense that it was not a single codified institution, but rather a set of practices that evolved over time and create a continuity between these early forms of enslavement of Native Americans in the 16th century all the way to the present forms of modern trafficking, human trafficking.
One of the things that you mentioned early on in your book is you explain that actually slavery existed before, you know, and we'll talk about Columbus in a minute, but, you know, before Columbus came to the, you know, this side of the world and all this, slavery existed in various forms, but it was never commodified, and that that was a big, big leap in terms of what we're talking about now in terms of this, the other slavery, was the commodification of slavery itself.
That's exactly right. Again, I don't want to give the impression that Europeans brought slavery to the New World. The enslavement or the holding of people in bondage is a universal phenomenon, and the New World was no exception to that. However, the way it was practiced in this continent prior to Columbus was in very culturally specific contexts and for very specific purposes. So Mayas and Aztecs took captives for sacrificial purposes. The Iroquois peoples waged what they called mourning wars on neighboring groups in order to avenge and replace deceased relatives. Or in the Pacific Northwest of the United States, captives were part of marriage arrangements between elites, indigenous elites. So all of these forms of captivity took place in very specific contexts. And those things changed, of course, once the Europeans were on the scene. And as you note, these practices became commodified and expanded in unexpected ways.
Well, when you're talking about the other forms, the earlier forms of this in terms of slavery, there was an actual, what would you call it? There was an actual production system prior to this, you know, hundreds and whatever years, hundreds of thousand years earlier. There was actually a system of organized society that was based on slavery, and that was different than what actually happened here in the when you're talking about what happened with Columbus on up through the Americas and whatnot. I mean, because remember, you know, there was the slave societies like in ancient Rome and various places like that, where, you know, a whole portion of the way they actually lived and the way they produced the things they needed to stay alive and flourish, it was based on the enslavement of whole people. So is there similarity between those two or not?
Well, yes, there were, of course, as I said, as I mentioned, forms of bondage and enslavement are a feature of the human race ever since we have memory of our species. But the ways those forms have occurred have changed over time. They now, it's interesting because For a few years ago, scholars made the argument that the forms of enslavement that existed in Europe before and during the age of exploration were markedly different to the ones that existed in the New World. And they were different, as we are mentioning, but they were close enough that Europeans, once they got to the New World, they were able to essentially reinterpret and fold the practices that they encountered in this continent into the understandings and the practices that they themselves carried from Europe.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump into one of the first people you deal with in terms of pushing all this forward, if you can talk about it being pushed forward, establishing all this, Columbus. You know, I never get tired of finding out dirt about Columbus, so let's get into this, man.
Sure. Well, it was a bit of a surprise to me as well. I never had seriously studied Columbus's motivations and discovered that he was quite the businessman. He is normally portrayed as a visionary explorer, and less emphasis is placed on his businesses and dealing and wheeling, and basically his whole idea to reach the Orient by sailing west was a money-making operation, and he peddled his scheme to various European courts, and some of these negotiations fell through because he insisted on terms on financial terms that that these various monarchies could not meet. So he was from the get-go a very, very mindful of the financial arrangements that he established. And the New World turned out a difficult undertaking because it turned out that it was not the Far East that he was looking for. It turned out that there was no silk, no precious spices, and but still he believed that he could make some money in the new continent. And one of the obvious resources that he did find was plentiful people. And before coming to the New World, he had actually visited the principal Portuguese slaving port in sub-Saharan Africa on the coast of Ghana. So he had seen how that was done, and that people could be turned into a profitable commodity. And as I said, I was not expecting, but I did find how his thinking evolved, and he very, very quickly, after arriving to the New World and finding that his dreams of wealth would be a little slower and the cost of mounting additional expeditions was increasing, he immediately proposed the wholesale exportation of Native Americans to the slave markets of Europe, of the Mediterranean, in order to pay for these additional resources that he needed, provisions and other resources that he needed in the New World.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show. Today we're talking with Andres Resendez, who's he's the author of The Other Slavery, a really fascinating book that I'm really urging people to go out and get, read it, study it, talk about it. And he's a professor of history at UC Davis. Now, Andres, let's jump in this a little bit more, because actually there was that point I think you make in the book too, where actually what you're just saying, Columbus, went there, and the involvement of gold and trying to find gold and all this, and there was a devastation that was unleashed on the Caribbean, on the people of the Caribbean. I mean, it was really pillaged. But then also the big thing that he actually, in terms of what he did, was this enslaving the entire populations and commodifying people and exporting them as slaves, which actually did turn people into commodities, which laid the basis for a lot of what developed in the so-called New World at that time, right?
Right. What's really interesting to me is that Columbus clearly, and he says this repeatedly and in letters, etc., wanted to export Indians and turn that into a business. However, the Catholic monarchs, Isabel and Ferdinand, his sponsors, initially agreed with this, but then very quickly turned against this idea. They became cautious about the idea of accepting Native Americans as an enslavable people. Now, slavery was by then a very tried and true institution throughout the Mediterranean. There were Africans being sold in slave markets. They were Eastern Europeans being sold in slave markets, people from the Levant, people from East Asia. From Near Asia. But standard that all of these people needed to meet in order to be regarded as enslavable had to be that they were enemies of the Spanish monarchy and that they had to be enemies of Christianity. And none of these standards were obviously met in the case of Native Americans. You could obviously make the argument that it was exactly the reverse. Europeans were the ones waging war on the New World, and the Native Americans were, from the very beginning, portrayed not as pagans rather than Muslims, for example, who were seen as far more threatening by Europeans. So it was a complicated decision to make, and very early on, Columbus had to wrestle with the opposition of his royal sponsors to his ideas of exporting all of these Indians. So that is a very different, and that is a fundamental distinction between African slavery and Native American or Indian slavery, in that early on, Indian slavery became illegal, at first with some exceptions, And by the middle of the 16th century, it became illegal under all circumstances. And yet it continued to flourish because that was the only way to continue the businesses that that the European colonists had in the New World. There was no other pool of labor that they could resort to, and they had grown accustomed to using Indians as slaves during the first half a century of colonization. So the practices continued, but they became clandestine. If anything, it became a more insidious story of trying to retain mastery over these Native Americans at the same time that that they tried to get around the law.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that really kind of was interesting to me, too, is that even as you're saying this, you also say in the book that Spain was to Indian slavery what Portugal and England were to African slavery. And it was different ways it fell out. But it was really important that in terms of it wasn't just that, you know, it wasn't just that the monarchs in Spain just sort of suddenly said, OK, we're not going to do this anymore. And then bam, bam, bam. But there was actually way people. They had workarounds in relation to that, as you're saying. Even the king and queen and all that, as much as they made statements against and actually took moves against certain forms of slavery, that they also found a way, Spain found a way, Spain itself, and whether it was the business people or whoever, they found a way to get around this stuff and actually pillage the world, basically, on that basis.
That's right. Yeah, that's one of the reasons why we are so late in realizing and discovering the scope of this other slavery. It's because it poses as legitimate work. And so Spanish colonists on the ground use all kinds of subterfuges and alternative terms and euphemisms to refer to the kinds of systems of bondage that they used in order to avoid referring to that or giving the impression that that was slavery. So they used all kinds of, I go into all the different forms that this took from encomiendas, which was a way in which groups of Indians were entrusted to Spanish overlords, to some sort of corvée system, to ultimately the use of indebtedness as a way to force Indians to work.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I found very interesting in the book, too, is that you also talk about the ways that even though, you know, that Spain had this official stand about we're not going to, and I don't know if that was forever, but it seemed like after that one, I can't remember the name of the royalty that said it was slavery was not going to be accepted. But there was all kinds of ways that they had workarounds around that, which you're talking to. And I thought actually it was very interesting because what you end up having is you have a situation where, and this I had never thought about this and knew about this, but the situation where you had the monarchy in Spain, you had the rulers in Spain saying, no, we're not going to have slavery. It's not going to happen. They would speak out against it. They would issue laws and edicts against it. And then you had the people in different parts of South America, you know, Central America, you had and in the Caribbean, you had all these people writing back and saying, well, that's nice, but really, we can't do anything about it. We're going to do it, you know. So I can't forget what the phrase was they used. It was something like, I agree, but can't obey.
That's exactly right. The name of the law is the New Law of 1542, and that was supposed to be a completely new compact. I mean, that was part of was a reaction to the complete devastation of the indigenous population in the Caribbean. And in the wake of that sobering and terrible experience, a group of royal activists decided to do something about it, and they promulgated this law that would start from scratch and establish a new relationship with the Native Americans. However, very early on, as you note, colonists found a way to get around the law, call it by different names, and in this way, the point that I make in the book is that by doing this, these institutions became far more difficult to track down, to realize the scope of it, and so in a way it mutated into a malignant cancer that remained throughout the colonial era, and went beyond that, went into the Mexican period and the American period. And I don't want to give the impression to the listeners that this was only a failing of Spain, which is very easy to do. It happened over and over. The Mexican government, the independent Mexican government, also granted citizenship to to all indigenous peoples who lived within the national territory. And that also didn't work. That didn't stop owners from exploiting Indians and holding them in bondage. And the same thing goes for the United States. In the wake of the Civil War and the 13th Amendment to the Constitution that liberated all the Indians, many southern states resorted to what are known as black codes, which essentially criminalized all kinds of activities like vagrancy and making obscene gestures, et cetera, and in a way established a regime that was remarkably similar to the kinds of things that that occurred in Spain in the aftermath of the new laws. So in some ways, the 13th Amendment, this may seem crazy to some of your listeners, but it is true in terms of the of the history of labor in our continent. It was another episode in which a grand prohibition of slavery resulted in adjustments in reality that tried to dismantle and get around the prohibition while retaining mastery over those former slaves.
Well, you know, one of the things that you point out in the book, too, is that there's a certain compulsion that they faced while they could have this these laws and all this other stuff in terms of and especially in terms of, you know, a society where you're beginning to get the development of capitalism and all this other stuff. You know, even as you have a monarchy, you have a feudal type system there. You have at the same time this, you know, profits were really a major, major force here. And when you look at Mexico and the relationship between the gold and silver that was in Mexico and was vital to the coffers of the of Spain, that actually had a lot to do with why people actually could get around all these laws outlawing slavery and saying that actually, you know, look, we have gold and silver here, and so therefore, yes, we agree, but we can't obey because, hey, get real, we got the gold and silver here and we got to get it out, you know. And that was actually a lot of the empire actually relied on the production and distribution of that gold and silver, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's easy to forget that. I mean, in the book, I make an interesting comparison, which is the one rush that we know about, metal-induced rush that we know about, is the California Gold Rush. 300,000 people decamped in the aftermath of the discovery of these nuggets of gold in a ditch in Coloma, California. But really, that was, by any measure, that was a small metal-induced rush compared to the silver rush that went on in Mexico from the 16th century all the way through the early 19th century. Whereas the gold rush lasted about 20 years, we're talking about 2.5 centuries. We're talking about a much larger geography. And we are talking about whereas in California is gold, which is generally found in, you'd need to dig superficially, silver, you have to deep these incredible shafts, including some of the deepest, in the case of Mexico, some of the deepest mining shafts in the world when they were completed in the 18th century. And because explosives were introduced only very late, these digging had to do essentially by hand, and somebody had to do it. So the mining industry in Mexico is a very good place in which to see these other slavery at work. It is some of it was done by African slaves. So throughout this period, African slavery was perfectly legal in Mexico and the United States, of course. And there are scores of African slaves working in these mines. But far cheaper, far more abundant were natives who were immediately pulled into the system. And suffice it to say that in just sheer volume, about 12 times as much silver was extracted from the earth as the entire volume of gold taken out of California in the 19th century. So that should give you a sense of the both the scale of this business and the tremendous need for labor to dig these holes, to take these ore out, to crush it into a very, very fine powder, to mix it with very dangerous compounds like mercury, and finally to extract the silver.
You know, Andres, there's something I have to ask you here because it's something that's really been bugging me, and you speak to this in the book, and that is that, you know, that Indian slavery, the enslavement of Indian people, was its own system, that it wasn't something in lieu of African slavery, like we're going to do this until the Africans are brought into the New World or something. It was actually its own system, but still there's very little known about that. Why is that, and what are the consequences of this?
Yes, I mean, that's a very good question. And there's no question about it. This is, I make the point at the very beginning that today, if you conduct an Amazon search, there are about 16,000 books devoted to African slavery, and there are just a couple of dozen monographs set in very specific places devoted to Indian slavery. So the disparity of our knowledge of these two systems is astonishing. And part of the reason it harks back to what we were talking about earlier, which is that Indian slavery was made illegal from early on, and therefore it officially did not exist. So it became a very complicated tangle of practices that could easily be construed as very different. Meaning, so for example, in the literature on Mexico, for example, there are works devoted to, I was talking about the encomienda system, the entrustment of Indians to Spanish overlords. There are books about the repartimiento system, another system. There are books about debt peonage, but all of these are in isolation. And we really need to take a step back and look at the reasons for these very complicated system of labor coercion and to try to understand how they all actually hang together because of these initial prohibition of or banning of Native American slavery.
Mm-hmm. Let me say this first. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andres Resendez. And Andres is a professor of history at UC Davis, and he's also the author of a really important new book. And the book is called The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. And folks, I'm telling you, you have to pick this up. It'll just blow your mind. All right. So now we'll jump back in. Andres, tell me this. You're talking about something I wanted to ask you about in particular, but I think you're covering it, is in terms of this Indian slavery was its own system. And it wasn't something that was it wasn't done in lieu of we'll just wait until we get the Africans here. But it was because, it actually was built around the Indian people. Let's talk about what the impact of this was on Native populations.
Sure. Well, I was very intrigued by these from the very beginning because the dominant interpretation that we have today, of course, about the depopulation of the Caribbean, which is where the book and the story begins in the Caribbean, is that, of course, many of these islands became depopulated largely because of virgin soil epidemics, bouts of deadly epidemics, including smallpox, malaria, etc. But interestingly, these very elegant explanation is not something that you find support for in the actual sources. If you look at the 16th century sources, there are some mentions of epidemics, but the overwhelming majority of the writers who are addressing this problem of the diminishing numbers of Indians talk about famines, they talk about war, they talk about overwork and exploitation, unbridled Spanish exploitation, etc. So the sources seem to be at odds with this explanation that we teach even in all the schools. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, I was very intrigued by the fact that if you look at the island of Hispaniola, which is the first home of the Europeans in the New World, it's the island shared by Haiti and the Dominican Republic today, there are virtually no mentions of epidemics until a quarter of a century after the arrival of Columbus. So for 25 years, there was no mention of mass death of Indians due to introduced illnesses. And yet, if you look at the censuses, so very early on in that island, the Europeans who settled that island essentially distributed the Indians amongst themselves. And so we have pretty accurate counts very early on and before this mass epidemic. So you can see that population is dwindling dramatically by as much as 95% from the time of contact. Now, I cannot, or people, scholars cannot rule out entirely the possibility of unreported earlier epidemics. But as far as we can tell from the sources, there are no reports of mass epidemic until a quarter of a century after Europeans first arrived in this island. And so the sources really talk more about exploitation, ruthlessness, warfare, etc. And furthermore, it is very clear that there is a synergistic relationship between epidemics and slavery. So the slaving raids actually spread germs and cause death, and death spurs additional raids because you need to replace the dead Indians. So clearly we're talking about a very terrible vicious circle here that existed in the Caribbean, and not only in the Caribbean but in many other parts of the New World.
Mm-hmm.
So I make the point in the book that I am very skeptical of biological only explanations about the decimation of indigenous populations. It is virtually impossible to determine to what extent Indians died because of man-made causes and to what extent it was epidemics. But if I had to guess, given the sources that we have at our disposal in the case of the Caribbean, I would say that probably more Indians died because of exploitation, hunger, warfare, etc., than because of biological reasons.
All right, that was part one of my conversation with Andres Resendez, professor of history at the University of California at Davis and author of The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with the conclusion, so stay tuned.
Once upon a dusty reservation, somewhere in the land of Sitting Bull, Johnny Lobo played with fire and dreamed of open spaces locked inside a heaven gone to hell. All the dreams were gone but not forgotten, murdered like the holy buffalo. Johnny Lobo knew the rules and grew into a warrior, fighting for his people and his soul.
All right, welcome back. That was Kris Kristofferson with his song, Johnny Lobo. Now, that song was written about John Trudell, a fierce fighter against the oppression of Indian people and against the U.S. government and all of these fiendish capitalist rulers around the world. All right, he was a man who stood up against all of that and paid a heavy price for it. Now we're going to return to the second and final part of my conversation with Andres Resendez. Let me ask you this. You know, when we're talking about the relationship between both, and I keep thinking about this in my head, the relationship between, you know, everything that you're saying, and especially in terms of, we know a lot about African slavery, about the enslavement of African people in the U.S. And I wanted to know, what is the relationship between, because you had the U.S. on the one hand is developing out there, and it's like actually on the, you know, the east part of the continent and all this other stuff, and it's spreading through, you know, towards the west, and you have a certain system there that actually in a huge part of that country, you have actually the enslavement of African people as the key way of production in terms of the South and whatnot and cotton and everything else. And yet at the same time, you have in a whole other part of the world and also in part of what would later become part of the U.S., you have this, in fact, this enslavement of indigenous people and the differences, the similarities and the differences. But what was the relationship between those two? I mean, I kept thinking, even as I'm reading your book, I kept thinking, was there ever a time when some of the indigenous people actually managed to hook up with some of the slaves? Did they learn anything about slave rebellions? Did they have, you know, what was there any kind of concrete relationship between them? And then what was the overall relationship in terms of these two different forms of slavery that were actually both forms of slavery and they existed within, you know, spitting distance. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, that's a very good question. The reality is that the two slaveries coexisted in the very same workplaces, amazingly enough. So, for example, I've looked at mines, silver mines that we were talking about in northern Mexico, where in that same shaft you would have African slaves, Indian slaves, free Indians, and free mestizos working side by side in the very same mine. So the two systems worked together. And furthermore, and this came to me as a surprise, in northern Mexico at the time, and this is, we're talking about the 17th century, an African slave was extremely expensive. To give you a sense, it was worth anywhere between 600 and 900 pesos because it had to be imported from halfway around the world. An Indian slave was worth only about 120 pesos. So if you were an entrepreneur trying to unearth these riches from the ground, and if you were working on a shoestring budget, chances are you would gravitate toward getting Indian slaves rather than African slaves. And if you had both, chances are that you would protect your investment in African slaves by putting the African slaves to work on above-ground operations that were far safer, and to use the cheaper Indian slaves in underground operations that, in case of cave-ins or death because of silicosis, which was very common, et cetera, you would be losing a lot less of your capital. So the two systems actually jive together in very specific enterprises like silver mining. That's one point. The other point that I would like to make is that it is easy to overdraw the contrast between the eastern seaboard of the United States and the West. So, with African slavery and the other with working on the basis of Indian slavery. In fact, there was an earlier period in the eastern seaboard in which Indian slavery was quite prevalent, as many scholars have noted. So, for example, the Carolinas and Florida were places where in the 17th century, there many of the businesses operated on the basis of Indian slave labor. It was just that in the course of during the 18th century and especially in the 19th century, the transatlantic slave trade developed, became far more affordable to have African slaves in the eastern seaboard. And essentially, African slaves had some advantages over Indian slaves. Indian slavery was always risky because they were enslaved and were relatively close to their families and friends and tribes. And so if you were a rancher or a miner out there, you opened yourself to reprisals by these groups. That was not a problem in case of African slaves. So there were some advantages to having African slaves as opposed to Indian slaves. And so they made a concerted effort to switch into African slavery to the point where by the 19th century, some of the colonists and the citizens of the United States had lost conscience of this earlier phase of Indian slavery in the eastern seaboard. And, of course, Indian slavery persisted much longer all the way through the 18th and 19th century, right into the early 20th century. In parts of the West and many parts of Mexico as well, and other parts of Latin America, of course.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andres Resendez, who's a professor of history at UC Davis, and he's the author of The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. Now, I have a couple of questions. Hopefully, you can keep going on with this because I have about four or five more questions, if you're all right with that.
Sure.
Okay, good. I wanted to talk about some of the things that come up in the book that actually kind of puzzled me. And one was that there's some of the unique features of the enslavement of Indian people did seem to be that women and children played a much bigger role than you normally would expect or you normally hear about or learn about in relation to the enslavement of African peoples. So that's one thing I wanted to ask you about was the sort of these unique features of Native enslavement and starting with this, the enslavement of women and children playing such a big role.
Sure. Yes, that is totally true. Overall, if you look at the entire transatlantic system, about two-thirds of African slaves were adult males, close to two-thirds. And that is in strike contrast to Indian slavery, in which the majority were women and children, as you point out. The reason for that is that many of these Indian slaves were, and there are, of course, there are some differences. So, but many of these Indian slaves were taken into domestic situations, and owners regarded women as more pliable and docile than men. They could also be, of course, sexually exploited. So in that sense, these Indian slavery is a forerunner of the modern forms of sex slavery. And the same thing goes for children. Children were far more adaptable than adults. They could learn languages more easily. And in the fullness of time, they could even identify with their captors. So they had distinct advantages over grown-ups. And these advantages were actually reflected in the marketplace. So I have found that throughout the continent, and from the 16th century all the way to 19th century, there was a price premium for women, whether in New Mexico or the Caribbean or Chile, women were worth more. Adult women were worth more than adult males in the marketplace of Indian Indian slaves. Sometimes the price differential was enormous, 50% or up to 60% more. And following women, adult women, were girls and then boys. And then way below that were adult males. And again, a number of factors that I just laid out had to do with these price differentials. So it's a very interesting feature of Indian slavery.
Yeah. One other question I wanted to ask you in relation to all this is Native complicity in the slavery of the Indian people themselves. The fact that you had, you know, like Comanches and is it Utes? Is that how you said it?
Utes, yeah.
Yeah. So you had this Comanches and Utes who actually were slave hunters and slave gatherers among the Indian people.
That's right. Yeah, it was an interesting, again, another interesting feature of Indian slavery. It actually was an interesting transformation. So initially, because of the tremendous military superiority of the European colonists, especially in the form of firearms and horses, they were able to basically raid at will neighboring groups. But as some native groups acquired firearms and horses themselves, some of them turned themselves into essentially procurers of slaves for both other Indian groups and for European colonists. And you mentioned two of the examples, Comanches and Utes, but there are others throughout the Americas, and that is a fascinating story. And that is a story that unfolded through the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. So Comanches, for example, which is the most fantastic case of this, they essentially became so powerful that they started raiding deep into Mexico. They took not only Indian but also mestizo slaves and sold them in the United States or traded them in the United States well into the 19th century. So I should, just to finish answering this question, I should say that, of course, we are acutely aware of this because these slavery is happening in the New World, but this is something that also happens with African slavery, as some Africans were complicit in the transatlantic slavery system in Africa. So again, this is not unique to Indian slavery, but to all forms of enslavement.
Mm-hmm. Now, another question related, and actually, this is a question I've been waiting to get into through the entire interview, which is, you know, you hear oftentimes, and actually among, in terms of slavery and in terms of the enslavement of African people here in the U.S., you have this whole, you know, a lot of the slave rebellions are never spoken about. And really, it's just been in recent times that people have sort of dug up some of the, like, astounding history, you know, over the last 50, 70 years, that people have begun to dig up this astounding history of the resistance that came from amongst the African slaves themselves. And in your book, you touch on something. You actually go deeply into something that I thought was really fascinating and really important for people to understand. And that was the greatest insurrection against the greatest. The title of the chapter is The Greatest Insurrection Against the Other Slavery. Let's talk about that, because that was extremely important in the face of everything you run down in the book about the horrific things that were being done to the indigenous people. Then you have this greatest uprising. Let's talk about that.
Sure. Yeah, I should say that it would be wrong to just portray Native Americans as pure victims. They were certainly victimized by the system that I'm describing, but they did a number of things to extricate themselves and to free themselves that range from using the Spanish legal system very effectively to claim their freedom to staging a massive rebellion, as the case that you're referring to. And I'm referring to the so-called Pueblo Revolt of 1680. This was an incredible rebellion in which various independent pueblos of New Mexico agreed to rise up on the same day and essentially kill or dislodge the Spanish presence in the entire territory. And they succeeded in doing so. They essentially kicked out the Spanish for a period of 12 years from the entire territory. And scholars have debated the reasons for this, but I try to show that that the enslavement that went on, New Mexico was one of the hotspots of Indian slavery during the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. I try to show that essentially one major motivation for these massive rebellion was the attempt to liberate themselves from the clutches of Indian slavery.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andres Resendez, who's a professor of history at UC Davis, and he's the author of The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. You know, and moving on to another aspect of this, which is California slavery, which, you know, a lot of people don't really understand or recognize. They think, okay, well, California, you know, it was sort of separated off from the rest of the country. And it was, you know, there was a lot of Mexico that was in, you know, California was part of Mexico. But there was a pretty strong enslavement of Indian people in California. And it was pretty brutal. Let's talk about that some.
Sure. Yes. Again, California was a terrible example in that labor demand. First of all, the California system, the California enslavement of peoples existed during the Spanish and Mexican periods. Sometimes it was in spite of the best intentions of officials. So, for example, the Mexican officials dismantled the California mission system, and the law essentially mandated the allotment of land to the neophytes, to the Indians who had lived in the missions. The predictable result of that well-meaning law was that wealthy and well-connected Mexican ranchers essentially took the lion's share of the land, carved out enormous ranches. And now they needed laborers to make these lands productive. And once again, as it had happened before, the only people they could turn to as laborers were Indians. And so a system of coercion of these natives developed throughout California in the 1830s and 1840s. They would conduct raids to various parts of California in order to bring back laborers, coerced laborers, into these ranches. And when Americans started coming into California, they essentially looked at this system of the ranchers. They were astounded by this baronial society that they encountered in California. But they also became a part of the system. And they did, there was a number of reactions to this. Some American settlers were more respectful of Indian rights than others, but there were plenty of Americans who became ruthless exploiters of California Indians. And these whole mix became explosive once gold was discovered in California. And then the acute need for labor essentially skyrocketed and created a terrible situation, and some scholars call it a wholesale genocide of natives in California. Mm-hmm. So yes, it is a fact of our history in California.
Mm-hmm. And actually, it's some pretty brutal and disgusting stuff that you actually expose in that section in your book. It's really, I was just sitting there seething as I'm reading it, you know. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, and we only have maybe one more question after this, but one of the things I wanted to ask you about was the Navajos. Because when you talk about an all-out assault against a group of people, when I was reading that in your book, What Happened to the Navajo People, it was incredible. And it was moving and it was enraging at the same time. And let's talk about that, because the Navajos seem to become a sort of a zero point, you know, sort of the target, the bullseye in terms of a whole campaign against the indigenous people.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I found quite interesting and quite instructive in researching this book and looking at the big picture is how different indigenous peoples became the preferred targets. And that those targets changed over time. So at first it had been the Apache Indians, but by the 1820s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s, and 60s, the Navajo Nation became the primary target of enslavement by Mexicans and Americans as well. And these all came to a climax during the Civil War years, when the Civil War in New Mexico essentially was ended very quickly, and what we have was a very large military buildup in New Mexico that was waiting for the rest of the country to sort of come to a resolution. And in the meantime, the military authorities of New Mexico decided to do something with this military muscle, and they decided to, quote-unquote, deal with the Indian problem. And they decided that the Navajo was the most aggressive and dangerous group that they had, and they decided that they would remove it to a reservation forcibly. That was the way to do it. In conducting this campaign, the American troops, soldiers, availed themselves to both Native auxiliaries, especially Utes, who had been the longstanding enemies of the Navajos, as well as Hispanic militias, who also had a longstanding tradition of taking Indians captive. And so this entire campaign, as you note, resulted in a heartbreaking wholesale enslavement of Navajos, who found themselves in a difficult situation as they are being moved en masse to a reservation hundreds of miles away from their stronghold, mm-hmm. in the Canyon de Chelly. So yeah, it's terrible, and you know, even years after that wholesale removal, the Long March, as it is known among the Navajos, there are all kinds of pieces of historical evidence, documents referring to the Navajo captives. So that's a very, very well documented, easily documentable, and really sad episode of New Mexico's history.
Yeah, sad and enraging. Let me ask you this last question. In the book, you make the comment that the other slavery had no legal basis, so it was never really explicitly abolished, and it continued into the 20th century. Let's talk about that. This isn't just a relic of the past. It's something that actually continued into the 20th century.
That's right. Well, in the final part of the book, I try to very briefly bring up the story that modern forms of enslavement actually are exactly what the other slavery were all about. So the modern forms of slavery are posed as legal work, yet they essentially exploit people at little or no pay. And they are designed to adapt to the legal environment of different parts of the world. So today, slavery is forbidden all over the world. even in the most recalcitrant parts of the world, like Mauritania, where slavery was legal up until relatively recently, all of that is illegal now. Yet the Walk Free Foundation estimates that around 45.8 million people around the world today are enslaved or suffer some form of enslavement. And these forms of enslavement resemble in some ways or are the direct descendants of these forms of slavery that Native Americans suffered for 300 years. That is, these covert forms of exploitation that take advantage of legal loopholes that pose as legal work. So in that sense, these other slavery is not just a historical curiosity, but it is something that really we need to bear in mind as we try to tackle these terrible and very enduring and very dynamic system of bondage that lasts until today.
Mm-hmm. All right, Andres Fresendez, thank you very much for your book and for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Michael. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Great. Thanks a lot, man. And we'll keep in touch, right? So the next time you're writing something or have more questions about this, I'll get in touch with you, all right?
Thank you so much. Of course.
All right. Take care, man.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Andres Resendez. He's the author of The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. And it's a really, I'm telling you, folks, it's an enraging and critically important book. And it really gives you a sense of how this world came to be what it is today. All right, that brings me to the end of yet another show. So I want to thank Andres Resendez, of course, for an interview that should give everyone a lot to think about and for producing The Other Slavery. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor and Matt Kriklinski. And I'd like to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. You can also find past shows and special interviews on my website, themichaelslateshow.com, and social media. Like my page on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and that Twitter is @michaelslate195. We're going to go out now with Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Indian Blood from The Last International. Talk to you again next week. Follow me, love, until tomorrow.